A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air. And Mumy and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now after the revolution. Debts were all forgiven in all the neo colonies. Soldiers left their bases, went back to their family.
This is the Quality News Network. 11 people who faced terrorism-related charges in London appeared in court today. 8 were charged with conspiracy to murder and plotting to detonate bombs on airliners of the Atlantic. 3 others were charged with other terrorism-related offenses. Investigators are still examining evidence, including electronic data, fingerprints, and bomb-making equipment. In Iran, the top nuclear negotiator has not indicated whether Tehran will suspend its nuclear program, as the West has demanded. But officials said in a letter to European negotiators that they're ready for serious talks. At the United Nations, U.S. Ambassador John Bolton says the U.S. is ready to prepare a new Security Council resolution. Iran would face economic sanctions if it refuses a Western incentives package aimed at halting its nuclear program. In Washington today, the U.S. Marine Corps will begin recalling thousands of Marines. They'll be sent to Iraq and Afghanistan to make up for a shortage of volunteers. The call-ups will begin over the next few months, and there's no cap on the total number. This is the first time the Marines have resorted to a recall since the Iraq War began. The Army has already recalled 14,000 soldiers. However, Britain says it may reduce its 7,000-strong force in Iraq by half sometime next year. That reduction would come after they handed over security for the South to the Iraqis. In Ohio today, Republican Senator John McCain faulted President Bush for not explaining to the American public how difficult the war would be. He said it was a big mistake to underestimate the size of the task and the number of sacrifices that would have to be made. In Minnesota today, President Bush signed an executive order to help consumers make better decisions about their health care. Federal agencies will be required to compile information about quality of care and costs and share the information with their customers and each other. In eastern Ukraine, all 170 people aboard a Russian passenger jet, including 45 children, have been killed. The airline was on its way to St. Petersburg from a Black Sea resort when it was reportedly struck by lightning. This is the third major airplane crash in less than 4 months in or near Russia. And in Israel today, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert indicated Israel will lift its air and sea blockade of Lebanon, but only after the international peacekeeping force is in place. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
California will soon have the highest minimum wage in the country. A bill signed into law today will raise it from $6.75 an hour to $8 an hour by the year 2008. Sales at retail chain stores dropped 0.2% last week, and some analysts expect disappointing retail sales for the month of August. Sprint Nextel's chief operating officer has been removed from the board of directors. The company faces strong competition and lower profits. Toll Brothers is giving up some building locations following a 19% drop in third quarter profits. Cisco is acquiring on-demand TV company Arroyo Video Solutions in a $92 million deal. Cisco is working to provide consumers with TV, movies, and video through the Internet. Tower Records has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, its second such filing in less than 3 years. The company operates 89 stores in 20 states. Ford is expected to unveil a new series of larger F-Series cleaner diesel engine trucks. The pickups will have more horsepower, better fuel economy, and a quieter engine compared to previous models. Ford is also reportedly preparing to extend buyout offers to all of its factory workers in North America. Light sweet crude settled today at $72.63. And at the close of Wall Street, the Dow is down 5 points, NASDAQ up 2, S&P 500 up 1. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White.
Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Six minutes after the hour on this Tuesday evening, at least where I am. Great to be with you. Great to have you aboard. You know, I try to make sure that I thank you from time to time for sharing your time with us. And you know my philosophy on this. The only thing you're never going to get more of, and you hear it all the time. Well, you know, I'll do that when I get more time. Sunshine, you ain't getting any more time. So I see your time as the most precious commodity that you have, and I value the fact that you do, in fact, choose to share it with Agnes, with me, with all your buddies here on the Head On Radio Network. So thank you. Tonight, we're going to have some fun. We have fun every night. But here in a couple of minutes, we're going to be joined by a gubernatorial candidate for the state of Alabama. You know, my birthplace, my native soil, as it were. Loretta Nall is going to be with us, and I'll tell you up front, Loretta is the Libertarian candidate, and she's having to run as a write-in candidate because Alabama has, and I want to discuss this with her because, you know, you're going to be getting this straight from somebody who's dealing with it. Alabama has the single most repressive ballot access laws in the entire nation. And there's got to be a reason for that. But in a state where liberals are afraid to, well, you know, Democrats are afraid to be liberals, afraid to be progressive, and they sit there and take it while a woman named Twinkles, the Alabama GOP chairman, tries to embarrass Howard Dean by offering to fly him to Alabama so that they can see what a dirty liberal Howard Dean is and what a bunch of dirty liberals Democrats are. That's the thing. One, liberals aren't dirty. Liberals are the only hope that this country has long about now. Because, after all, it was liberals who have done everything that was worth, accomplished everything worth having in these United States. The entire history of the country. Thomas Jefferson, liberal. George Washington, liberal. Ben Franklin, oh my God. Thomas Paine, the religion industry's still mad at Thomas Paine. But and arguably Abraham Lincoln, liberal. Because, of course, the original Republican Party was started as a liberal party. Now, I understand there was a flip-flop in the 1960s, and LBJ himself said, well, you know, we've lost the South for the next generation. Well, okay, LBJ, that generation's over. And it's time to start fighting back and start taking it back. And everything that I have read by Ms. Nall suggests to me that she has real liberal thinking. Now, of course, the nature of the tent is such that we will not always agree on every issue. I suspect that she and I would not be at complete agreement on her stance regarding public education. But on many others, oh, my lordy, lordy, I think you're going to be pleased. Right now, Agnes has Ms. Nall on the phone and is having a wonderful chat with her. So I'm going to have to get her. Thank you, Agnes. So we are joined at this time by Loretta Nall, Libertarian candidate for governor of the state of Alabama. Loretta, what a pleasure it is to talk to you. Welcome to Head On.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm glad to be on tonight. And hello, listeners.
Well, it is absolutely my pleasure, especially, you know, as I told you in my introductory note, I'm an Alabamian, too. I'm in West Virginia now. My family's from here, but I was born in Florence.
So you feel my pain.
I know your pain just all over the place. whereabouts in Alabama are you from?
I live in Alexander City, which is eastern central Alabama, near Auburn, kind of north of Montgomery.
Okay, we'll forgive that Auburn part.
Oh no!
But
yeah, let's not go there.
Okay, but you're running for governor, and in a race that is seen largely as being won between Lucy Baxley, comes from an old political family, as the Democratic nominee, and Bob Riley, sort of God's candidate, or say, if one believes what one is told by the Republican Party down there. Why are you in this fight?
I'm in this fight because neither one of those candidates represent any of my, you know, my thoughts and desires and wishes for the society that I live in. And that's, you know, that's ultimately when it all came down and all this got started back in 2002, my initial response was, I'm going to run for governor. And your listeners, just an overview, I wrote a letter to the editor of the Birmingham News decrying the marijuana laws and saying we needed to change them. And the police in Alexander City, Talbot County, used that letter to get a search warrant to come into my home and arrested me for what they say was less than 1 gram of pot, 87 hundredths of a gram, put me in jail, tried to take my children.
That'll
be about enough of that.
Yeah, I've read extensively on your website. And by the way, give folks, when we get a chance, give folks your web address and, your website, because you have written extensively, and I tell you what, you are a wonderful writer, and you lay out these issues so clearly, so cogently, and with so much common sense. But yeah, you wrote a letter to the editor of the Birmingham News, talking about the screwed up drug laws, not only in Alabama, but in the country. And the next thing you know, you're getting your house rousted, and they claim to have found an envelope sitting on top of your printer, as I understand. Is that correct?
With my name on it.
Yeah, with your name on it. And, you know, circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back. Right. And what, three stems, a stem and three seeds?
Yeah, that's about what it amounted to.
And in the meantime, and I don't want to dredge up anything that because this is every old wounds sometimes ache the most.
No. I
they sorted, you know, through the ashes of your dead son.
Yes, they did.
Oh my God!
I lost a son in 2000. I lost a baby to SIDS, and we weren't home when the police came in. We came home to find, you know, all the officers already tearing through the house, and I have the urns in my bedroom that they had taken it and placed it on my bed and opened it, you know, you can sift it through, and that's, you know, it's basically, it's grave desecration in my book.
In most any reasonable person's book. So you got roughed and cuffed and rousted to the station house. Obviously this didn't slow you down.
No, this is actually, you know, when it's all said and done, Bob, I'm going to send him a fruit basket and a thank you note. It was, it was the...
How nice.
It was, you know, I would have probably continued to be something of a closet smoker, and not really ever stood up and started fighting for, you know, a change in these laws if that hadn't happened to me. I'm kind of like, was like everybody else, you know, I'm fine. The cops don't know me. I'm not, you know, a troublemaker, and I'll just, you know, keep it like it's always been, and it's good to go. And then when I thought I had the right to voice my opinion, and they came, and they did all of those things. Not only did they, you know, desecrate the grave of my youngest son, they called the Department of Human Resources to try and take my two living children, and had, you know, that, you know, for months thereafter, DHR and the police were showing up at the school to question them without counsel. It was just a nightmare. And, you know, I began to really understand what people go through for, you know, for using, you know, smoking a little weed here and there. And I said, you know, I just, that's just wrong. And so I began to study about the drug war and announced my intentions to enter the, you know, the gubernatorial race. No one took me seriously. No one, either, like, oh, yeah, you're crazy. But, and maybe I am. I guess that you have to be a little crazy to jump in with both feet.
Well, but, you know, the fact of the matter is I get a sneaking suspicion just based on what I've read that you're going to poll a lot more votes than people might have anticipated.
I believe that as well, and there's a lot of things playing, you know, in my favor in this election. One is, last week, the Alabama Stand Talibanocrats, and this is the Democrats, actually, in this state, came out with a new covenant.
Oh, I read that thing.
And it was completely Republican. I mean, there is absolutely zero difference, and they're so far removed from the National Democratic Party platform that you wouldn't even recognize them as Democrats. So, I mean, really, and people understand that it's come down to they only have one choice when they vote. If it's just a Democrat and a Republican wanting, you know, running in a race, it's still, you're voting Republican. And Lucy Baxley makes me so angry because, you know, they come out and they label her as liberal, you know, and it's like she's a damn Democrat. She's supposed to be liberal. You know what I mean?
But she's not.
She run from it. So.
But she's not a liberal.
No, absolutely not a liberal.
I mean, I read
have to retract the ad.
Yeah, I read that. I read the covenant, Loretta. And I didn't see anywhere in there about making health care available, let alone affordable, available to every child in the state of Alabama. I didn't see anything there about Alabama moving proactively to raise the minimum wage for because, you know, if we wait for Washington, it ain't going to happen.
Right.
You know, there's nothing about a living wage. There's nothing about all the evils of right to work, which is right to starve. It's like a blight on the South, and it accounts for frankly the immigration problems that the South
Absolutely.
Has. The AFL-CIO has statistics that say that over 2/3 of Americans, given the opportunity, would gladly join a union because it means that they get a level playing field with their employer.
Right.
None of that in this covenant. On the other hand, I saw some blurb, but we will cherish life.
Yeah,
what the heck?
They're big pro-lifers, and we, you know, I work as an escort in Montgomery at the women's facility, and I guess it was about 2 weeks ago, so it's been going on all through last week. The Christian Coalition, the Alabama Association Against Abortion, and the three or four, you know, actually altogether it was like 8 different religious groups with 3 representatives, they met in secret with the Alabama Health Department to pressure them to adopt Mississippi's abortion laws, which are the toughest in the nation. And within days, they had gone into the women's clinic in Montgomery where I act as an escort, and said they didn't have a backup physician on call, and so they revoked their license. And
oh
what had happened
God.
Was they'd had one on call up until the day before, and the health department had called him. And he called and said, why are they calling me? They said, well, you're the backup doctor. He said, not anymore. And this was at 3 on Monday, 10 a.m. on Tuesday morning. The health official swooped in and asked for the backup physician, and well, lo and behold, you know, she hadn't had time to replace him. And they snatched the license. So,
and of course,
it's the life begins at conception thing.
Yeah, but this isn't going to hurt some well-heeled woman with plenty of money. She can always go somewhere else. This is a full frontal assault, Loretta, on poor folks.
Oh, absolutely. And it's funny to me, because it's always a circus in Montgomery when we're escorting. And we have to escort because the real religious wackos, and I'm not throwing off on religion.
That's okay.
There's a lot of really good people that I love that are Christians, and I would never offend them.
I understand.
But the people that show up to protest at abortion clinics are
goobers.
Vile, you know?
Yeah, they're vile.
They're scary. They're absolutely frightening.
Well,
and they're the first ones to vote Republican and then scream, you know, racial epithets that don't need to be having kids if they can't afford to feed them. And, you know, welfare, this and that. So in their own you know, their own reasoning is so circular. It's such circular logic that it's, you know, wow, it's maddening sometimes.
Well, I can't help but notice that most of the abortion protesters outside clinics and elsewhere, Loretta, are usually guys about, you know, 50-something guys with the comb-over haircut, comb-over hairdo, and, you know, could stand to lose 150 pounds and, you know, griping about, you know, them women's.
I'm telling you, it's, you know, they don't have ovaries, uterus, or vagina, or a mammary gland.
Yeah, grow one and you get a vote.
Until they do, they have no say in this matter. It's between a woman and her doctor.
Absolutely. Amen. But you've, you know, you are more than, I'm loving this conversation, by the way. You are more than a one-issue candidate.
Absolutely.
You've studied what faces Alabama. It's not just the drug war. You've got very cogent positions on immigration. And oddly enough, you have come out and you know, I frankly think when you speak plainly like this, you speak you walk in the footsteps of some very, very great people. And when you say things like the immigration policy, is racially motivated, I was just proud reading it, Loretta.
I mean, it really is. You know, I work and network with some of the people at the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. And when you look at who shows up at the rallies in Montgomery and who, you know, they're holding anti-immigration rallies across the state, and you look at the media on every, you know, I've actually been to a couple of them just to see, and it's white supremacists, it's the Klan. They burned a cross in, I believe it was Russellville, Alabama, back earlier this year.
It was in June.
Primary elections and in a immigration protest, and it's all the ignorant, racist, backwards, toothless, snake dancing, tobacco chewing idiots that inhabit this state that always make us look like such fools.
Oh, can I give you a radio show, Loretta? Can I give you a radio show?
Yeah, sure, I'd love one. I'd be dangerous, though. Watch out.
Oh, this is so energizing to hear coming from an Alabamian. Because I have said all, you know, I despise conservatism, Loretta. I despise, you know, what is, you know, passed off to us as conservatism. For me,
right.
Conservatism is the fact that right now I have to make choices of things like milk or gasoline. You know,
exactly.
It's made, that's the kind of conservatism that I have to deal with. And frankly, you know, that's the nature of being a family in George Bush's America. But this conservatism that says that, white America is somehow more deserving, and that's what it comes down to, because frankly, there's no great agglomeration of, people of other races who have really benefited under the Bush economy. It's all hooey, and what I tend to think, and I've said it to a number of people, when the powers that be start hearing liberalism taught and progressive thought talked by folks with accents like yours and mine and several other people that call this program, that is when their bowels are going to turn to water.
You know, I would tend to agree with you, but the thing that stumps me there is people in Alabama are polling 66% against the Iraq war, and we haven't pulled out yet. And I'm going to tell you what, when people in Alabama say they're tired of kicking the ass of brown-skinned people, you know something is up. And I don't know why Washington's not paying attention to that, you know what I mean? So it's like, wow.
Well, but, you know, dear leader said yesterday that he's, we're not going to leave Iraq so long as I'm president.
He said, "Now, if we leave, the terrorists will get the oil." So I guess it's now a full on.
Well, and then it was, and if we leave, the terrorists will follow us here, like some sort of puppy that we found, and you know, yipping at our heels all the way back to America, like we're going to let them on the planes.
Really, and it's just politics to fear. And you know, I don't know if you got to read my Columbia article today. I traveled to South America in 2004 in the jungles of Putumayo for about 10 days, studying the aerial fumigation and. Carried out under Plan Colombia, which is the U.S., you know, international drug policy bill. And I didn't, until that time, I didn't really have a good grip on why people around the world sat and plotted to blow us up. I didn't get it. You know, I thought we were still the good guys in white hats. And it took going to a foreign nation and seeing the effects of our foreign policy on the lives of these incredibly poor people who are basically subsistence farmers and wash their clothes out in the creek on rocks. you know, and destroying their habitat, killing, you know, their kids and their animals and their water. And then I understood. And the only thing that's going to get us out of the kind of situation we're in right now in Iraq is to leave people alone.
And
Stop trying to, you know, force democracy in there. I mean, the only democracy that will ever work for people is the kind that they get for themselves.
Yeah, it doesn't happen at the point of the gun, and only a darn fool or a charlatan thinks it does.
Amen, brother.
But the, you know, the operative word in what you just said, leave Iraq, is leave.
Leave.
You know this, and I don't know if you share this thought or not, but if we say that we're going to be there for 2 years and then we'll pull out, or 10 years and then we'll pull out. Well, the same thing happens at day one after pullout, 2 years from now, 10 years from now, or day after tomorrow.
Exactly.
The only mathematics involved with any of this is, Loretta, is how many more Americans are we going to get killed? How many more boys from Op and Wetumpka and Huntsville and Arab and Sand Mountain are going to die?
We're up to 47 last count from Alabama. You know, everybody knows, of course, the people that go are the kids who, you know, didn't get a scholarship to college, and their family's too poor to send them. It's not, of course, the senator's sons, as our friend John Fogerty once said. So, you know, there's a lot of anti-war movement in Alabama. There's, you know, a lot of people that, like I said, 66% are polling. We want out. And that says, you know, it says a lot to me, all humor aside, about, you know, Alabamians being mean to people with brown skin. I mean, it really does say something. Because, you know, people down here love war. Of course you do. You grew up here. People.
Yeah.
It's like football, you know?
Oh, look.
And
it's
when they're saying pull out, it's like, whoa, hold on a second.
Oh,
I
had three trips in 3 years to Shiloh when I was in junior high school. So, you know, well, yeah, we revel in it, and I've told people on the air here, in third grade I was taught that it was the War of Northern Aggression. Not that
they probably still teach that.
Yeah, and you know, the fallback position on that was war between the states, and it was, you know, it was a switch, and if it was the Civil War, wasn't no Civil War. That's what Mr. Lincoln said. but no, you are so correct. Let me move to a couple of other things. You and I think you and I probably have a difference of opinion on the public schools.
I
got the sense reading your positions that you've pretty much given up on the public school system.
The public schools would be fine if you could get the damn federal government out of them. I understand the need for a public education system, but I want one that works. I mean, we're continuously in, you know, the bottom 50, you know, and 45, 43, and there's no child left behind nonsense that they're forcing on everybody. I talk to the public school teachers. They hate it. You know, it's not about teaching kids, and it's all social doctrine, it seems to me like. You know, there's a lot of things that are being taught in school that are, you know, disguised as you know, fundamental basics of education that really aren't. Let me tell you, my kids went back to school about 2 weeks ago. They're, you know, they attend a public school because I live out in the middle of nowhere, and there's only, you know, religious private schools here.
Yeah,
it's not religious.
Yeah, because if you don't send them to the public schools, they're bringing snakes home.
Exactly. So, you know, we pulled up on open house night, the night before school started back, and the very first vehicle you went past was a city police car with a drug dog in the back. It's like, welcome back to school, kids.
Charming.
You know, and you know, it's just like, to me, the DARE program is the cops are in there scouting for the next generation of inmates. They're going to pick out the little troubled kids that they can follow, you know, up until they graduate. Now they don't even wait until they're 18. You know.
Well, and apparently that's already happened because of what, I mean, I saw one proposal on your website where the governor, they're going to database problem children in Alabama.
Exactly. The Democrat.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, yeah, wanting to create a government database that could be used when kids transfer between schools. And it's like, you already have that. You have school records, which include disciplinary sheets.
Oh, my God. I lived in constant horror of my permanent record.
Really?
When I was in the public schools in Alabama. You know, this will have to go on your permanent record, son. Oh, God. You know, I'll never get to community college now.
I just think that, you know, we public schools are fine. We need to let teachers teach, and we need to, you know, opt out of unfunded federal mandates like No Child Left Behind. That shouldn't be forced. You would save a lot of money. You know, the teachers know what they need in those classrooms, and, you know, some, you know, weird career bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. has never met our kids. and they, you know, they don't know our kids, and so they shouldn't be allowed to tell us what we have to teach our kids.
Well, I
do support, you know, letting or making it easier, as easy as possible for families who just say, you know, I just don't trust the public school system. I'm about at that point myself.
Well,
you know, get together and form, you know, some sort of private school. It doesn't have to be religious-based or, you know, I don't want there to be any impediments to, you know, families who say, I don't think so.
So as governor of Alabama, you would freely fund up to the minute math curricula for Alabama's public schools. You would freely fund up to the, you know, language, linguistics, foreign languages.
Absolutely.
But you might draw the line at a Bible as literature class.
That would have to. Yeah, I'd be real unhappy about that. And they, you know, the Democrats are trying to reintroduce that again, if you can dig it. And it's, you know, in somewhere like, I don't know, California, where people maybe have a better understanding of the literature in the Bible than they do here in Alabama.
Yeah, where it's the inerrant word of God. Yeah,
you know, you could maybe, you know, something like that, you know, kids could. But here, I mean, I just see it as a way for, you know, the evangelicals to force their warped view of Christianity on school kids. And
well,
I don't think so.
Okay, well, I'm glad I touched on this issue because, frankly, it was the one place where I was kind of going, oh, Loretta, because it, you know, I really do, you know, if you take away the public school system, you really are shoving the nation a lot more toward feudalism, at least because then education becomes a matter of choice and economic ability as opposed to a matter of right. But you know, I understand every word you've just said about the DARE program and dogs in schools and rousting out children and God knows. No, I agree. I want to have a moment of technological adventure here, if we could, Loretta. We've got a caller on for you, David from Eureka.
All right.
David, are you there?
Yes, I am. And Loretta, I'll make it real quick. I want to know how much of a problem do you think election fraud is in this country? What do you feel about electronic voting machines that leave no records? And do you have any thoughts what you'd like to do about that?
There's a lot of fraud in the elections. The last two presidential elections should have not left a doubt in anybody's mind. Here in Alabama, we've had a lot of problems in the primary about absentee ballots. There were three or four different places in the state that, you know, absentee ballots were, you know, outnumbered, you know, people actually voting in the district and, you know, weird signatures and things of that nature. It's terrible. And then our Senator Jeff Sessions only just recently, and I believe Richard Shelby as well, voted against renewing the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and then later on they came back and changed their minds. But as far as electronic voting machines, they should not exist because there is no paper trail, and we will not have them here in Alabama that I'm aware of. At least they're not viable. The ones that we have do actually have a paper trail. There's been, you know, our Secretary of State is under fire from the Department of Justice. They just appointed Governor Riley as the Commissioner of Elections, I believe, because the Secretary of State's being sued. Alabama has some very major problems with election fraud and just really not having it together properly, which is not really shouldn't surprise anybody. We've got a 33% illiteracy rate in the state, so that things kind of get messed up here sometimes. Really is a it's a given.
Okay.
I believe those machines are designed to cheat. It's very deliberate, very calculated. It's how we've got what we've got in Washington right now.
Right. I agree with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Dave.
Have a good evening. Loretta, you hit on a couple of things there, or rather a tangential issue that I know is very near and dear to your heart. It's one thing whether or not your vote gets counted.
Right.
You know, you go up and you play Ms. Pac-Man on the D-Bold machine for a little while, and you think you've voted. You don't know if you've voted, but the fact of the matter is, it's the buttons you get to push on that screen. Your campaign is of a write-in nature. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. We have the reason that I'm a write-in candidate is because we have the worst ballot access laws in the nation in Alabama. If you're an independent or a third-party candidate, you have to have signatures totaling 3% of the last number of people that voted in the gubernatorial election, and this year it was 41,300. If we had managed to get that, I would have gotten on the ballot. And then once you're on the ballot, if you don't take 20% of the vote in the election, you have to requalify all over again. So So being, you know, we have limited funds, of course, and so, I, you know, we did the best we could. We got about 15,000 signatures with what we had, and I'd known from the beginning that it was going to be almost an insurmountable obstacle and said I'm going to run anyway. So my campaign is a writing campaign, and I have been assured by Ed Packard at the Secretary of State's office in Montgomery that they will be counting, reporting, and tallying the votes for me along with the other two gubernatorial candidates on November the 7th. Even though they're actually, they're not required to, but they absolutely, they have assured me that they will this time.
Well, they, it's the, they don't have to?
No, not generally, because a lot of times when you have a lot of write-in, people will vote, but they don't like either of the candidates, and so they'll write in things like, you know, Daffy Duck or Mickey Mouse.
Oh, well, okay.
It's just a lot of, you know, silliness just as a protest, kind of, and so they don't, you know, they don't have to do that. And you know, even if somebody's running a write-in campaign, but I, you know, I talk to them, and they're going to, absolutely, they're going to, because I, it's such a, you know, it's a major campaign, and they would be, well, they'd be, you know, very unhappy. Mm-hmm. I would be very unhappy, and therefore they would very soon become very unhappy if they didn't count my vote.
Yeah, the next newspaper story would be, Loretta goes to court, that kind of thing. Yeah. you do have a significant following, and these are energized people. The people in Alabama, the folks who are behind you, I would guess are quite frankly far more politically savvy than your average party apparatchik in that state. Would you agree?
I do. There's actually, you know what, I forgot to turn my call waiting off. I hope you guys are hearing that.
That's okay. We didn't beep.
It'll pass.
We're very high tech.
Okay. Just a couple more to be done.
Okay. No, you've got these savvy voters, these savvy followers. Alabama is, I mean, in terms of just Simon Legree meanness, Alabama's got to take the cake when it comes to income taxation. Where do you stand with that?
You mean as far as like how much do we pay, or should we pay more?
Well, you know, like the way that the income of the poor is taxed.
I've looked at a plan given by Alabama Arise that would, and they work on behalf of impoverished people in Alabama. We definitely need to restructure our tax program, because we do, you know, the poor pay, and we did some work on that this year. I believe the bill will be signed in October by the governor that restructured it. We had, was it $4,500, I believe, was the threshold, and then they raised it to $12,000, which isn't nearly enough. I would raise it up to, you know, $20,000 for starters, and see how that went, because I mean, in today's economy, it's just, you know, it's unbelievable. You know, $3 a gallon of gas, like you said a few minutes ago, and I can't imagine having to pay any taxes on $4,500 or even $12,000. That's not, you know, for a family of four, I mean, that's really horrible. So, you know, I think I could get away with getting them to, you know, raise it up to $20,000, and then we would go from there.
Okay, well, that makes perfectly good sense. What about the corporate structure in Alabama?
You're getting into an area where I don't have a lot of
Well, I mean, let me flesh that out for just a second here. The property taxes, you know, you've got the family homestead. You pay some of the absolute lowest property taxes in the entire country in the state of Alabama, and I like that. I think where families are concerned, that's the same philosophy as what you were talking about with income taxes on the poor. On the other hand, if you've got 90,000 acres of timberland, you're paying next to no taxes on that either. And somewhere along the way, you know, you were talking about keeping the federal government out of the school system.
Well, this is where I go to being a libertarian here. I hate taxes. I understand the need for them. Right now, there's a big battle between the Republicans and Democrats about whether we should have annual, yearly appraisals of our property. And A lot of people are real unhappy about that. Governor Riley started doing it in 2002 when he was elected, in 2003. And, you know, Lieutenant Governor Baxley is, you know, saying it's the very first thing that she's going to, you know, repeal when she takes office, if she takes office. I hate having to pay property tax, to be honest with you. I mean, I own my property and the house that sits on it, quite frankly, and it's like having to pay rent to the government every year.
It feels a lot like that.
I'm not a fan of raising property taxes. Not at all.
Well, yeah, and I agree with you.
People that, you know, to have the 90,000 acres of timber that they're, you know, turning a huge profit on, yes, they ought to be made to pay a little bit more.
Something that's near and dear to us here in West Virginia and also exists in Alabama, Loretta, is a coal industry.
Absolutely.
We have seen probably more than Alabama.
That's really frightening. You know, even in 2006 in Alabama can say things like that and, you know, and expect to be taken seriously. But, you know, I digress. Weird time.
Well, it is indeed. Loretta, thank you so much for your time. I hope we will hear more from you before the election. Is there anything that folks can do to help?
Get on the website, check out all I'm doing. If you like my work and what I stand for and the things that I'm trying to bring to Alabama, consider making a campaign contribution. There's links on the site or an address if you'd rather do it that way. Send me an email if you'd like the show and just, you know, drop me a line that says hello. I like to hear from people.
What's your email, Addie?
It's on the website under contact.
Okay, great. Loretta, thank you again. Thank you so much. I consider you a new friend of the program. This has been a wonderful conversation, and I hope we'll hear from you again. I will cut out a copy of this interview and make sure it comes to you in your email so that you can do with it. Maybe put it on your website, for folks to hear.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Best of luck. I have a feeling you're gonna shock and surprise. Gonna be a little shock and awe. Come November.
Shock and awe of my own. Eh?
That's right. You take care now. Have a wonderful night.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Loretta Nall, candidate for governor of Alabama on the Libertarian ticket. I generally, you know, got to tell you, you know, I'm not much, I don't do the Libertarian thing. And I don't agree with Ms. Nall 100%. But by golly, I think it's safe to say that I'm with her about 95-97% of the way. Because, you see, this is something I've talked about in the past. This is a perfect example of something I've talked about in the past, and namely, it is time for people to start being willing to do it themselves. Loretta Nall was motivated by a couple of things that happened in her life, motivated to try to change things in a place that she loves. I probably should have asked her, because somewhere along the way, some snotty right-winger will. Well, if you think things are so screwed up in Alabama, why don't you just move to one of those blue states where, you know, where the gays are all getting married and they hate Jesus and stuff? You know why she did that? Because I feel comfortable answering this question for her. She doesn't do that because she thinks too much of where she is. Because there are wonderful people in the Deep South. People with a sense of nobility, people with a sense of tradition, people with compassion that you would be hard-pressed to better anywhere else. And this is not me turning my nose up anywhere else in the country. But to one extent or another, Alabama helped create Loretta Nall. Loretta Nall is trying to give back to where she's from. We can't retreat into little blue corners. If we don't get in their faces, the so-called conservatives. I mean, I described it at one point in Alabama. I watched the political advertisements prior to the primary, and there were Republicans. Well, you know, my opponent in the primary, he's not as conservative as I am. He don't appreciate our conservative family values. And you know what? I heard that on Republican ads, and I heard that on Democratic ads, and it was hooey every time I heard it. I don't think Loretta Nall's playing that game. Listen, we'll be back. Your phone calls are always welcome at 877-443-2366. That's 877, the numeral 4. Head on. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Herbst. I play Elizabeth Weber on General Hospital. I want you to know about a wonderful nonprofit foundation called the Jesse Cause, saving the babies from Group B strep, also known as beta strep. It's named after little Jesse, who needed 3 brain surgeries, all because his mom was never given a simple test. Group beta strep is the leading infectious killer of newborns in the United States, yet most people have never even heard of it. Amazingly, 1/3 of all pregnant women have beta strep, and it's almost 90% preventable with common antibiotics. Tell your friends about beta strep, and if you're pregnant, ask your doctor to test you. Together, we can save the babies and put an end to this devastating yet preventable bacteria. For more information, call toll-free at 877-HALT-GBS. That's 877-HALT-GBS. Or log on to groupbstrep.com. That's groupbstrep.com. Jesse and I, thank you.
Are you still looking for weapons of mass destruction? Concerned about the future of the Supreme Court? You want to know how government bureaucrats are changing Social Security, overtime pay, or the environment? Maybe you just want to know if the president's lying to you, or when our troops in Iraq can finally come home. I'm Mark Levine. I've got the inside scoop. When you want to know what's going on inside the Beltway, you need a Beltway insider. Someone who's worked in the government and still has sources willing to give you all the news from Washington the government does not want you to know. So for lively debate, reasoned opinion, detailed analysis of history and policy, or just a point of view you don't hear expressed in the mainstream media, tune in to the Inside Scoop. Feel free to call in too. Agree or disagree. All opinions are welcome. It just might make you think. That's the Inside Scoop, weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, 1 Central, 11 o'clock Pacific, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
I got a feeling I'm going to wind up seeing that movie. I don't do horror movies, but I'm hearing too much good stuff about Snakes on a Plane. Of course, I can't see the title Snakes on a Plane. I'm Bob Kincaid, by the way. I can't see the title Snakes on a Plane without thinking Snakes in the White House. You remember the first the Schwarzenegger movie, Conan the Librarian or whatever? They had James Earl Jones, and he turned into this really big, ugly snake, you know, back when he was behind closed doors. That's what I imagine goes down in the White House. I want to share something with you. This is why talking to the South means something to me. One of the greatest books of the 20th century comes out of the darkness of apartheid Alabama. It's Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. And it is one of the most profound and moving pieces of writing that you're likely ever to run across. I want to share just a little passage with you, if I could. Here we go. This is Jean Louise Finch's first day of school. Scout's first day of school. And Miss Caroline printed her name on the blackboard and said, "This says I am Miss Caroline Fisher. I am from North Alabama, from Winston County." The class murmured apprehensively, should she prove to harbor her share of the peculiarities indigenous to that region. When Alabama seceded from the Union on January 11, 1861, Winston County seceded from Alabama, and every child in Macomb County knew it. North Alabama was full of liquor interests, big mules, steel companies, Republicans, professors, and other persons of no background. So it comes on to lunchtime. "Everybody who goes home to lunch, hold up your hands," said Miss Caroline, breaking into my new grudge against Calpurnia. The town children did so, and she looked us over. "Everybody who brings his lunch, put it on top of his desk." Molasses buckets appeared from nowhere, and the ceiling danced with metallic light. Miss Caroline walked up and down the rows, peering and poking into lunch containers, nodding if the contents pleased her, frowning a little at others. She stopped at Walter Cunningham's desk. "Where's yours?" she asked. Walter Cunningham's face told everybody in the first grade he had hookworms. His absence of shoes told us how he got them. People caught hookworms going barefooted in barnyards and hog wallows. If Walter had owned any shoes, he would have worn them the first day of school and then discarded them until midwinter. He did have on a clean shirt and neatly mended overalls. "Did you forget your lunch this morning?" asked Miss Caroline. Walter looked straight ahead. I saw a muscle jump in his skinny jaw. "Did you forget it this morning?" asked Miss Caroline. Walter's jaw twitched again. "Yeah," he finally mumbled. Miss Caroline went to her desk and opened her purse. "Here's a quarter," she said to Walter. "Go and eat downtown today. You can pay me back tomorrow." Walter shook his head. "No, thank you, ma'am," he drawled softly. Impatience crept into Miss Caroline's voice. "Here, Walter, come get it." Walter shook his head again. When Walter shook his head a third time, someone whispered, "Go on and tell her, Scout." I turned around and saw most of the town people and the entire bus delegation looking at me. Miss Caroline and I had conferred twice already, and they were looking at me in the innocent assurance that familiarity breeds understanding. I rose graciously on Walter's behalf. "Miss Caroline..." "What is it, Jean Louise?" "Miss Caroline, he's a Cunningham." I sat back down. "What, Jean Louise?" I thought I had made things sufficiently clear. It was clear enough to the rest of us. Walter Cunningham was sitting there lying his head off. He didn't forget his lunch. He didn't have any. He didn't have none. He had none today, nor would he have any tomorrow or the next day. He had probably never seen three quarters together at the same time in his life. I tried again. "Walter's one of the Cunninghams, Miss Caroline." "I beg your pardon, Jean Louise." "That's okay, ma'am. You'll get to know all the county folks after a while. The Cunninghams never took anything they can't pay back. No church baskets and no scrip stamps. They never took anything off of anybody. They get along on what they have. They don't have much, but they get along on it." My special knowledge of the Cunningham tribe, one branch, that is, was gained from events of last winter. Walter's father was one of Atticus's clients. After a dreary conversation in our living room one night about his entailment, before Mr. Cunningham left, he said, "Mr. Finch, I don't know when I'll ever be able to pay you." Let that be the least of your worries, Walter, Atticus said. When I asked Jim what entailment was, Jim described it as a condition of having your tail in a crack. I asked Atticus if Mr. Cunningham would ever pay us. Not in money, Atticus said, but before the year's out, I'll have been paid. You watch. We watched. One morning, Jim and I found a load of stove wood on the backyard. Later, a sack of hickory nuts appeared on the back steps. With Christmas came a crate of smilax and holly. That spring, when we found a croaker sack full of turnip greens, Atticus said Mr. Cunningham had more than paid him. That's the Alabama. That Loretta Knoll wants to do right by. That's the Alabama that Loretta Knoll is not going to be run out of. I applaud the guts it takes to stand up against the kind of machines that exist down there. And I applaud the willingness to stand up and do it yourself. And I'm proud we had that conversation. And for God's sakes, go and read what this woman has to write. If you don't read anything but the Great Panty Rebellion, I think your time will have been well spent. I'm not going to tell you that story because the reading of it is far better, and it is in the grandest tradition of To Kill a Mockingbird to read it. Loretta is intimately acquainted with the punishment fetish that is the so-called justice system of the state of Alabama. And that's the way real grassroots politics is born, isn't it? It's when we the people see something wrong with our government and set out to fix it. Because I've said before, and you didn't take issue with me, there's a whole lot of stuff in this nation that is just plumb broken. And Republicans aren't going to fix it. And I'll be honest, there's some Democrats that have no interest in fixing it. And when I see Democrats like that, I'll tell you. Here's one. Bill Nelson in Florida. He's not interested in fixing anything. Ben Nelson in Nebraska. He's not interested in anything, in fixing anything. Joe Lieberman. Well, he used to be a Democrat. He's not interested in fixing anything because everything, as far as they are concerned, works. It's you and me down here on the ground, not living in the clouds, that notice the stuff that gets broke. Because you know what? The statues generally break at the feet. Remember the poem Ozymandias? Yeah, that. Look, it's time for the top of the hour news. We've got another interview coming at the bottom of the hour. We're going to be joined by Larry Matheny, Secretary Treasurer of the West Virginia AFL-CIO, and he can tell us a little bit more about what's happening to working people in America and in West Virginia as a result of the monsters who have attacked working people for low these last 5 years and more. In the meantime, let's have a little talk. Phone number 877-443-2366, 877, the number 4, Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is the Head On Radio Network.
This is a Quality News Network. In London, 11 people facing terrorism charges appeared in a courtroom today, with many entering not guilty pleas. 8 are charged with conspiracy to commit murder by plotting to detonate airlines over the Atlantic. 3 others are charged with related offenses. In Iran, the top nuclear negotiator has not indicated whether Tehran would agree to suspend its nuclear program. Rather, he says they're ready for serious negotiations. Meanwhile, U.S. Ambassador John Bolton says the U.S. is ready to prepare a new Security Council resolution that would impose financial sanctions on Tehran. In the Gaza Strip today, Israeli soldiers backed by tanks and helicopters moved into Palestinian-controlled areas near the main cargo crossing point. Three Palestinians were arrested and three Hamas militants were wounded. In the Mediterranean Sea, an oil slick caused by an Israeli airstrike has begun sinking to the ocean floor. A newly released video shows oil spread over a 100-yard wide area. The cleanup could take a year and cost $64 million. In Rome, the Italian foreign minister said his country would contribute up to 3,000 troops to the international peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon. But that's only if Israel complies with the ceasefire. Italy is also expected to lead the 15,000-member force. In Washington today, the U.S. Marine Corps announced it's recalling thousands of Marines to make up for a lack of volunteers in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's the first time the Marines have resorted to a recall since the Iraq War began. In Baghdad, Saddam Hussein's second trial continued into its second day. He's charged with using chemical weapons to kill tens of thousands of Kurds in the late 1980s. In southern Afghanistan, a Canadian military convoy was hit by a suicide car bomb today. Four troops and one Afghani civilian were reportedly wounded in the attack. In Washington, an analysis of the Senate's immigration bill concludes that it would increase federal spending by $126 billion over the next 10 years. The Congressional Budget Office says that includes funding for law enforcement and building fencing and vehicle barriers. Another potential hurricane is churning off the coast of West Africa. It's now a tropical depression, but weather officials say it could grow into a tropical storm later today. Officials expect at least seven hurricanes to hit the U.S. this season.
In addition to producing and distributing the finest hourly newscasts in the country, the Quality News Network conducts interviews with 2006 candidates. We afford congressional and gubernatorial challengers of every political stripe the opportunity to illuminate their views and to demonstrate their character in a 20-minute network-quality interview. We perform this public service to enable voters to get a better listen to the people they might consider electing to high office. Because as Thomas Jefferson said, if a nation expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. If you want to know more about who is running in the November elections, go to qualitynewsnetwork.com and click on 2006 candidates. If we are to get America back on track, we need to elect people who can lead us in the right direction. Now, back to the news.
Federal experts have issued a report that says Bausch & Lomb's Renew with Moisture Lock was the only contact lens solution that contributed to a fungal eye infection outbreak, but it's still not clear how the solution caused the potentially blinding medical problems. Sales at retail chain stores dropped 0.2% last week, and some analysts expect disappointing retail sales for the month of August. Sprint Nextel's chief operating officer is leaving the country and being replaced by its chief executive. Sprint acquired Nextel last year in a $35 billion deal. Toll Brothers is giving up some building locations following a 19% drop in third quarter profits. A housing analyst says the market is falling much faster than expected and luxury homes are discretionary. Cisco is acquiring a private on-demand TV company, Arroyo Video Solutions, in a $92 million deal. Cisco is working to provide consumers with TV, movies, and video through the Internet. Tower Records has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. That's its second such filing in less than 3 years. And the latest national survey of average gasoline prices find that they've fallen by 7 cents to $2.92 a gallon. But that's still 31 cents higher than this time last year. Light sweet crude settled today at $72.63. At the close of Wall Street, the Dow is down 5 points, NASDAQ up 2, S&P 500 up 1. You can hear more at qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
6 minutes after the hour, hour number two. Head on, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is an anniversary of sorts. Not of sorts, it is an anniversary. Not one I'm particularly proud of. This is the 10th anniversary. Can you believe it? This is the 10th anniversary of the great stiffing of the American poor. And from the New York Times today, headline, a welfare law milestone finds many left behind. This is the 10th anniversary of the welfare reform, where, frankly, Bill Clinton felt like he had to run a preemptive strike on the Republicans and take an issue away from them. However, you know, I don't know. Call me crazy. Call me liberal. Call me progressive. Call me a crazy liberal progressive. But I don't think it's very much of a preemptive strike on the Republican Party to screw the poor before the Republicans get to. But we did. Over the last 5 years, Mashita Autry has received welfare checks and food stamps, gone through a welfare-to-work program, and briefly held several jobs. She also has given birth to her second and third children. Ms. Autry, 25 years old, with a 10th grade education, was finally overwhelmed by the demands of work and family, and in February she showed up at the People's Emergency Center, a social service agency, with her three children, a fourth on the way, no job, and no place to live. She has exceeded the usual 5-year limit for receiving welfare, and although the state has given her a reprieve, her benefits will be cut off, she has been warned, if she does not resume full-time job skill classes and a job search within 8.5 months after her new baby is born. Hey, isn't that pro-life? As political leaders give two cheers on Tuesday for the 10th anniversary of the welfare reform law that helped draw many single mothers from dependency into the workforce, though often leaving them still in poverty, social workers and researchers are raising concerns about families that have not made the transition and often lead extraordinarily precarious lives. Don't you love it when the New York Times uses words like extraordinarily precarious lives? Oh, it's just precarious. My goodness gracious, my stars, it's precarious. It's not precarious. It's miserable. It's, Thomas Hobbes? John Locke? Thomas Hobbes, I think. Life is nasty, brutish, and short. Most men lead lives of quiet desperation. Women, too. Perhaps more quietly and more desperate at one and the same time. This is an anniversary of shame. While the alphabet networks on cable have been orgasming all over themselves all day long, what is Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's big secret for August 22nd? It happened again on CNN. I didn't see where anybody had picked it up at Crooks and Liars or anything like that. And, of course, I didn't grab it either because it was just one of those bing, 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 missed it kind of things. There was Kira Phillips. I think it was Kira Phillips. And coming up on CNN, is this the end of time? A lot of people say so. Many believers think that today Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in Iran may cause the end of the world. I hate that crap. But, you know, there's only so many retellings you can give of what a miserable failure George Bush has made out of his war of choice. You know, I don't know how to put this without really winding up hating myself. But if you're gonna start a war that you don't have to start, and maybe this has a little something to do with my southernness too, because as Loretta Knoll noted, you know, we like us some war, Southerners. But if you're going to start one, and you don't have to start one, could we at least insist that you win it? But, of course, that's the problem with the Iraq War. It's unwinnable. It was lost before it was started, because when you start them and you don't have to start, and when you go and participate in wars that you don't have to participate in, and when you start them, that by definition means you didn't have to participate in it because it was your choice. Yeah, that's the only, yeah, okay, yeah, it's not a woman's right to choose, but it's a president's right to choose to go, oh my God. When you choose to start them, you automatically lose them. And that's where we are. 2,600 and, what is it, 7? 10? 15? 2,600? We're on our way now. We've passed 2,500. We're on our way to 3,000 American dead. To add to the 3,000 who died in the World Trade Center attacks, pancaking, whatever you want to call what happened on 9/11, depending on what you choose to believe or not believe from the federal government and the outside sources. This is not the purpose of that. This is not that conversation. But we're going to match the innocent civilians that we lost on September 11th. With 3,000, 3,500, 4,000. How many? Are we just going to, I mean, is this some sort of really sick death envy that George Bush has where he wants, you know, I'm going to leave a legacy as a president by having a bigger monument than that stupid black wall here in Washington. I want 60,000 names. Is that it? Yeah, we'll make my war memorial like a shaped like an oil pipeline, and it'll snake all around the reflecting pool there on the mall. Lord, Lord, Lord. But you know, we got our welfare to work program, didn't we? Yeah, I'd say we did. We got our welfare to work program in the form of young people, no future, no hope. Young people named Matthews and Smith and Ramirez and Lopez and Perez, who got their welfare to work program in the form of the United States military, and baby, they're dead now. There's your welfare to work. And it's men, and it's women, and the one thing that it is most assuredly not is the way that America is supposed to be. The story in the New York Times concerns itself with one individual, 25 years old, whose life is hell. But it is a story that is repeated time after time after time after time. These precarious lives include mothers who, so beleaguered by personal problems and parenting that they have not been able to keep jobs, continue to need counseling and cash. They also include another large group of poor mothers, 1 million by some estimates, who are neither working nor receiving benefits. Just sort of let that slowly sink in. 1 million mothers, neither working nor receiving benefits. Yeah, there's your quiet desperation. Neither working nor receiving benefits. How are they getting by? Their mothers, what are their children eating? What passes for a roof over their head? Are the children in school? Are the children adequately clothed? Does anyone care? The Republican Congress doesn't care. Republican governors don't care. The Republican Senate doesn't care. The Republican president doesn't care. The Republican Supreme Court doesn't care. Republican legislatures don't care. Republican mayors don't care. Who cares? Yeah, who cares? Yay. Who cares? Hate to get all boring and biblical on you, but may I remind, may I remind the Republicans, not you, because you do care. And you're going to go to the polls in November, and you're going to try to put people in office who do care. You're going to try to put people in office like Tony Trupiano from last night. That guy cares. In West Virginia's 2nd Congressional District, you're going to try to put Mike Callahan in office because Mike actually cares. And you yourselves will do what you can to change the situation because you care. But may I remind, and let us remind, because a lot of us were raised the same way I was, let us remind the Republican Party of a certain few words, that if ye have done it unto the least of these, ye have done it also unto me. And if ye have not done it unto the least of these, ye have not done it unto me. And in November, perhaps we'll do another one from that thin tome, and we'll say, "Begone, ye wicked and accursed." Let's take a break. When we come back, a little bit of time before your phone calls, then we'll be talking to Larry Matheny.
One, two, three, four.
This is the Head On Radio Network. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Walking down the highway heading to New Orleans. A thumb in the air and a pair of tight jeans. He'd fallen on the lean time, so all he had to pack was some 8x10 glosses and a shirt on his back. His pink Eldorado was looking good, with a chrome candelabra welded to the hood, with a Walmart keyboard and a makeup bag. He was headed for the big time and going in drag. It was hell on the highway, his feet were getting sore. The batteries in his Walkman didn't work no more. He raised a thumb, then flipped a finger to a passing Dodge, then saw the pink Eldorado. It looked like a mirage.
The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business, anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
In the early hours after the tsunami, it was ham radio that was on the air, saving lives. When Florida was ripped by hurricanes, the hams were there. In the critical moments after the attack of 9/11, it was the hams who coordinated emergency messages. When disasters strike, the hams are ready. Ham radio works when other communications don't. To learn how you can become a ham radio operator, call the ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio, at 1-800-326-3942.
We often hear claims Muslims don't condemn terrorism.
And that Islam condones violence.
As Muslims, we want to state clearly
that those who commit acts of terror in the name of Islam are betraying the teachings of the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad.
We reject anyone of any faith who commits such brutal acts.
And will not allow our faith to be hijacked by criminals.
Islam is not about hatred and violence. It's about peace and justice.
Want to fight childhood asthma? Then fight it with a scrub brush and a hot soapy towel. Even in the neatest and tidiest homes, if there's so much as a crumb to eat or a drop to drink, household pests like bugs and mice will do all that they can to get it. Creepy crawlies like bugs and mice are unpleasant enough as it is, but they're more than just a nuisance for kids with asthma because they can actually trigger an asthma attack. So, give them a whole lot of nothing. Sweep up crumbs, wipe down tables, scrub dishes before they pile up in the sink, and store leftovers in plastic bags or bowls. Don't leave them so much as one tidbit or nibble, and you can stop a childhood asthma attack before it starts. Discover other simple ways to prevent an asthma attack. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS or visit noattacks.org, because no child should feel like a fish out of water. A public service message brought to you by the U.S. EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
Okay, let's take a little more look at the stirring anniversary of welfare reform. In particular, I'm looking at a blog posting from the Huffington Post today by Tracy McMillan. She says, "10 years ago today, on August 22, 1996, Bill Clinton struck a dicey bargain based on a premise that only a rich man would find credible. To end poverty, people had merely to go to work." Yeah, sure. Jinx, Agnes is saying every word I'm saying right now. But Tracy McMillan says, "That's true if you've got minimum wages starting around $20 an hour, public health care, free child care, and housing subsidies for anyone who needs it. Unless I've somehow missed something in 5 years on the poverty beat, none of that describes the contemporary situation in America, particularly as our economy has shifted from one of industry and the high unionization rates that guaranteed livable wages within that sector to one of largely non-unionized service. There is a wide range of full-time jobs that simply do not pay enough to lift a family out of poverty. In one very real sense, welfare reform is a broken promise to those that have borne the brunt of it because they've gone to work and yet remain poor." Yeah. Absolutely. But you understand that there's so much hypocrisy and, dare I say it, sexism in so-called welfare reform that it shocks the conscience. Why is that? Well, we're talking here, and the New York Times piece is a good example of it. We're talking about women. In overall poverty situations, you know, yes, men play into it, but, you know, let's face it, even if mommy and daddy are married like the Republicans want them to be, because that is a holy institution mandated and authorized by God, If they're making minimum wage, mommy and daddy, they still cannot lift their children out of poverty. And that's just a fact. But we are talking mainly about women. And of course, we're also talking about the family values crowd. We're talking about the Dobsons of the world who want, you know, daddies to expose themselves to their young sons in the shower and all that sick crap. But we're talking about women. You know, women whose business is not to be in the marketplace and not to be out there working. You know, last I checked, you know, the Republicans want us to return to Leave It to Beaver land, where June Cleaver stays home all day and perfectly unschmutzed in a starched A-line dress with petticoats underneath and walking around in 3.5-inch pumps waiting for Ward to come home to their 2.35786 children. And the woman's job is to have a meal on the table and the laundry done and the windows washed and the floors swept and the carpets vacuumed and monogram towels hanging in the bathroom. Right? Where did all that go when the Republicans started? But, you know, you understand, Republicans hate poor people. They hate working people. I don't know, maybe it's even worse than that. Maybe if they ever gave thought to working people, they would bother to hate them. Otherwise, it's just a general disdain. But you see the hypocrisy of this. This, you know, this is the world that we have tolerated. This is the world that we live in. This is the world that we struggle in. A world where gasoline and milk are virtually the same price. So you choose between being able to, get to work tomorrow morning or the children having something to put on their cereal or to have cereal. You see, that is where America is in 2006. And that is what makes November 2006 so absolutely critical. This is our chance to fix things. This is our chance to make right. This is our chance to begin a healing process and a process of healing working people, because it's working people that are suffering and hurting right now in America. Warren Buffett himself has said, yes, it's a class war and my class is winning. You see. So, at this point, let's go to the phones. We are joined by Larry Matheny, who is Secretary Treasurer of the West Virginia AFL-CIO. Larry, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for the invitation. I've looked forward to joining your show, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, I wanted to have you on mostly to talk about the upcoming rally in Charleston this Saturday, but I think you could probably give us some good perspective on what's happening to working people, not just in West Virginia, but in America as well. And that's a big part of what Saturday's rally at 2 p.m. at the Byrd Federal Building is about, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Bob. And I just caught a few of your comments as I called in, and I couldn't agree more. And Warren Buffett's remarks about the rich folks are winning is absolutely true, and we're certainly not seeing class warfare, Bob, but I've been telling folks now for quite a while that this country is truly being run by greed, pure greed, and we see those in the middle class sliding down toward the bottom, and we see those at the bottom growing poorer yet, living in poverty. And I've been trying at least to make the point that what we're seeing today, the dynamics of what we're seeing today, isn't about liberals. It's not about conservatives. It's not about red. It's not about blue. It's not about Republicans or Democrats. It's about pure greed, and it's an up-and-down issue, and we need to look quickly at who's on top and who's on the bottom.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, the on the bottom part is people working for minimum wage. It's people working for substandard wages. It's people who don't have a living wage. And yet those same people, Larry, are the people who are carrying this nation on their backs.
Well, you know, Bob, you certainly know, and your station is a champion for workers. And I don't think that anyone can argue that wages are stagnant. Those living in poverty, the numbers are growing. The unemployment statistics are just a shadow of the truth of what's happening in this country. Many have just literally given up. There's at least four workers competing for each job vacancy, regardless of how low the pay. And
Larry, is that a national statistic?
Yes. Yes.
Oh. So every time a job opens up, no matter how low the pay or how lacking in benefits or how lacking in dignity, there are four people vying for that job?
That is exactly, as I'm told. And, Bob, as we hear this current administration, the Bush administration, talk about job creation, the job creation numbers are so low when compared to those entering the workforce that there's just not enough jobs being created to support those who are searching for work.
Well, this is a profound problem, and this is the kind of problem that can wreck a nation, you know, not just today, not just next year. This is literally about the future of the republic, as far as I can see it, Larry. What do you have any suggestions? Does the AFL-CIO have any suggestions for beginning to fix this problem?
Well, you know, what we have strived for quite some time is to restore worker rights, the right to organize freely, form free democratic unions in this country, as guaranteed by the National Labor Relations Act. We want to see every worker have an opportunity to achieve that American dream. We want to see a free quality education. We want to see workers and their children have an opportunity to have a higher education without fighting a war to afford it. We want to see workers have the opportunity to have health care that's affordable and pharmaceuticals that they can purchase that would ensure a good quality of life into old age and security of strengthening the Social Security program, not weakening it by privatization. And last but not least, that we see the Part D pharmaceutical program straightened up so that it's not just a program that benefits the pharmaceuticals and insurance companies, but truly benefits seniors in need.
Well, that's I'm so glad you mentioned that, Larry, because among other things, a Medicare Part D that includes what I've been told is called the donut hole, older Americans continue to pay but don't actually receive pharmaceuticals or benefits thereof. That's no benefit.
No. You know, Bob, today there's 10 times more lobbyists in Washington, D.C. than there were at the end of the Clinton administration. The pharmaceutical companies alone have over 600 lobbyists in D.C., more than one per member of Congress. That's the story.
That's obscene.
That's obscene.
Well, this rally that's coming up on Saturday is part of a larger national effort, is it not?
Yes, we have joined in coalition with progressive groups such as Citizens Action. We've joined with the Council of Churches, the National Association of Social Workers. We've joined with environmentalist groups. We've joined with those who have interest in community safety. We have the West Virginia AFL-CIO has joined with many partners who share the same concern that we do and formed a group which we're calling West Virginians United. On Saturday, August 26th, beginning at 2 p.m., we're going to be at the Byrd Federal Building in Charleston on Virginia Street. And we're going to have folks be talking about the environment. We're going to be talking about worker rights. Then we're going to march together to the offices of the AFL-CIO at 501 Leon Sullivan Way, and we're going to join with the champion of workers and the champion of West Virginia, our Senator Byrd, and we're going to join with president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, and we're going to join with the champion of the 3rd Congressional District, Nick Joe Rahal, and we're going to talk about what's wrong with this country and what people must do to set it right, to correct the course and get us back where we belong. And the primary issue we have is think about what you're doing, folks, and go vote on November 7th.
And don't, yeah, and vote in such numbers that it won't, that it hopefully won't even be close.
That's exactly right. Here in West Virginia, Bob, we hear Don Blankenship say that he's going to have thousands in the street going door to door. We hear him say that he's going to spend whatever it takes to change the face of the legislature of West Virginia. Well, Bob, I'm here tonight asking folks to please come join with us on Saturday, August 26th, beginning 2 p.m. at the Byrd Federal Building, and let's send Don Blankenship a real strong message that says West Virginia is not for sale.
I couldn't agree with you more, Larry. And beyond the rally, there's a little bit of fun afterwards, too. The rally is going to be fun in its own right. But then it gets a little more lighthearted after the rally culminates at the AFL-CIO headquarters, doesn't it?
At 5:30, we're going to encourage everyone to march together to over to Power Park. And we're going to have Labor Night at the park. And we've already sold over 500 tickets. So Labor Night at the ballpark is going to be a lot of fun. You're exactly right. The game starts at 7:05, and anybody that's listening to this show that wants to go to a ball game, this is the night to do it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let me move to another topic because, you know, the AFL-CIO is central to this, Larry. And you know that's laborers and plumbers and pipe fitters and electricians and steel workers and but you guys are taking this fight you're taking this fight on not just for your own membership.
Absolutely not. We represent workers, Bob, and workers' families. And if I might share with you my view of the West Virginia AFL-CIO,
sure,
being, I consider it, the most pro-life organization in the state of West Virginia. From the moment a child breathes air, we want to make sure that it has health care to ensure it grows beyond adolescence. We want to make sure that mother has postnatal care to ensure that she recovers and is able to continue a healthy life. We want that child to be able to go K through 12 and have a free quality education regardless of where they live. We want that child to go to college and not have to be so deeply in debt that it would never be able to pay off the loans required to go. We want that child to graduate and receive an opportunity to have gainful employment that allows it to own a home, have children, educate their children, and grow into old age with a Social Security program strong enough to make sure that we don't have an aging generation become totally dependent upon their children for care. That's the position of the West Virginia AFL-CIO, regardless of members, whether they are union members or non-union members. If they work in the state of West Virginia and they're trying to raise a family, they're trying to work hard, follow the laws, we're with them and for them.
That is, that to me is, Larry, it's got a lot of what I learned growing up in the church. It's got and it is absolutely pro-life. That's the real pro-life, Larry. Let me ask you this: you mentioned non-union families that or families who may not have the opportunity to join a union. You've got a program out there for folks like that, don't you?
Yes, we do. And sadly to say, Bob, in this country today, polls tell me that 57 million workers want to belong to a union but can't out of fear of employer reprisals, fire you for union activity, make life so miserable that you'd end up quitting, that sort of activity. So we have a lot of people that don't belong to unions who would love to belong to unions. And the AFL-CIO has created a program called Working America. And you don't have to make a public statement. All you have to do is sign a card telling us you want to become a member of Working America. And by doing so, we submit your name to the National AFL-CIO, and then that allows us to make you a member of a directly affiliated local union of the AFL-CIO, which in turn allows us to legally communicate with you regarding issues that are important to workers and their families.
Is there a website for Working America, Larry?
Yes. Just go on the AFL-CIO website and click on Working America, and you can find all the information there.
Is that AFLCIO.org?
That is correct.
Okay, and click on Working America.
That's correct.
And this, I mean, and folks, I mean, you're not asking them for their money. You're just trying to make them part of the process.
This is about coming together to share information that would allow workers who don't belong to unions have the information at hand to allow them to make critical judgment of politicians that they will cast their ballot for at Election Day.
Well, you know, Larry, I was talking before you called in, I was talking a little bit about the anniversary that's taking place today. This is the 10th anniversary of so-called welfare reform.
Yes. Yes.
That has just, you know, it just made life harder for a whole lot of working families. Because, you know, I think we tend to neglect that or a myth has been created, Larry, that people who receive public assistance somehow don't contribute to society and don't work. But that's not true, is it?
Bob, we have seen at least one generation grow up with that thought. And what I challenge your listeners tonight to consider is that we talk constantly in West Virginia about that guy that lives up the hollow that seemingly has no issue that would prevent him from working, that gets some sort of subsistence check every month. And we never have the debate about a guy like Don Blankenship who will make $90,000 or $100,000 a day for doing nothing.
Well, he's running his company into the ground last I checked, didn't he?
That's right. But yet today there's no criticism of his poor performance running his company, is there?
No.
But we might hear about someone living up a hollow somewhere and getting $500 a month to put food on the table, and we'll criticize that person. So I challenge your listeners tonight to let's start criticizing those in this country. As we see wealth concentrated among fewer, let's criticize those folks to go to their post office box each month and pick up checks that are in the millions.
Absolutely. And, you know, the fact that we see this so plainly in the attempt to tie a $2 raise in the minimum wage to a tax break for Anna Nicole Smith and Paris Hilton. That's the very epitome of this. It's a disgrace.
It's a disgrace. And I have heard so much reference to the death tax, Bob, that I also would challenge your listeners to let's start talking about the birth tax. This Congress, this administration, not long ago, raised the debt ceiling of this nation to $9 trillion. Now, I'm saying tonight that what they've done is they've placed a birth tax upon my great-great-great-grandchildren. And they have the audacity to talk to me about a death tax.
Oh, I know. It's not just your grandchildren, Larry. I mean, right now, somewhere in this nation, a baby is being born.
Yes, sir.
And that baby born at this very instant owes something, has, you know, that first breath you talked about?
Yes.
With the first breath that baby draws, that baby owes something like $40,000.
It's saddled with that debt without ever having any input to its life. And we've allowed that to happen in this country, and we ought to be screaming. Everybody needs to be screaming. There's a lot of wrong, and we need to say it very clearly. You're wrong. We need to look at what we're doing, folks, and let's get off single divisive issues and think about what puts food on the table and breath in our lungs and water in our in our stomachs. Let's talk about real issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so proud to hear, Larry, that you characterize pro-life for what pro-life really, really is.
Well, I tell you what, I'm very proud of the West Virginia FLCO and its members. And the members that I represent are generally God-fearing, good people.
Mm-hmm.
And the people I know certainly want to see that child live in a world where it has opportunity. And that child live in a world where it's not threatened with illness as a child that may prevent it from growing it to maturity. The members that I represent care. And it grinds on me to no end to hear a single issue group talk about, well, we're pro-life, meaning only that we've protected an embryo.
Well, exactly, and to hear the other side talking about the curse of welfare on America, that $500 check that's feeding people, and at the same time, Larry, at the same time, that $500, you know, the $500 in food stamps is a means by which the government subsidizes the food industry.
Bob, when we as a society say that we want to see this country degenerate to the point where we care not about those who have less, this society is done. The very thing that has separated us from other societies is over, and I see that happening.
Is it stoppable? I mean, you've got to believe, Larry, because you wouldn't be doing what you're doing if you didn't.
You believe it can, and I believe it can, and we know it must. We have no choice, Bob.
But it begins in November, doesn't it? I mean, it begins now.
November.
But November it seems like every election that comes along becomes a little bit more critical.
Well, what we've seen successful is we tell lies, and they become truths.
Yeah.
You and I know, as students of history, that in the 1930s in Germany, there were lies told and very craftily stated to where if you say them long enough and loud enough, they become true. And we're seeing those same tactics appear again. Here we are in the 21st century.
And it can break us just like it broke that nation.
Absolutely.
Larry Matheny, thank you very kindly
for
your time.
I thank you, sir, for all you do for workers, and just keep up doing the good work. And I look forward to talking to you again.
I will be there. I'll be there. My family will be there on Saturday. We're really looking forward to all of this, Larry. And thank you so much for being a part of organizing it.
Thank you, and I look forward to meeting your family.
All right. Take care, Larry.
Goodbye.
Bye now. Larry Matheny, Secretary Treasurer of the West Virginia AFL-CIO. I want to share with you again, especially if you do not have an opportunity to be affiliated with a union, if you're like that those 57 million working people in America who, given the opportunity, would gladly be part of an organization whereby they could stand together to improve working conditions, improve safety, improve wages, improve benefits, have a meaningful pension. If you're part of that 57 million, there are a couple of things you can do. And this is motivation for November. The Employees Free Choice Act is out there. It's in Congress. The Republican Party would rather keel over dead and turn green and rot in place than ever see that bill move. The only way it happens, the only way this bill becomes law, is with a Democratic majority in the House and the Senate come November 2006. Secondly, a website. The website, AFLCIO.org. And there is an internal link there called Working America. There's no snake oil here. This isn't about getting you. No, this is just a straightforward attempt to pass information to working people in the United States of America so that we can make America a better, stronger place for the people who make America what it is. Employees Free Choice Act, Working America. Check it out. This is the Head On Radio Network. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
Gee, Bill, you certainly have a lot of patience and courage.
Well, I got this far. When I started, I wasn't even a bill. I was just an idea. Some folks back home decided they wanted a law passed, so they called their local congressman, and he said, "You're right, there ought to be a law." Then he sat down and wrote me out and introduced me to Congress, and I became a bill. And I'll remain a bill until they decide to make me a law.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I got as far as Capitol Hill. Well, now.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Californians are set to receive a big wage increase and come closer to pulling ahead in the race for the highest state minimum. An agreement between Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Democratic-controlled legislature will bump the state minimum wage to $7.50 per hour on January 1, 2007, followed by a 50-cent increase on January 1, 2008. The 2007 raise will lift California into fourth place for best minimum wage, following Connecticut, Washington, and Oregon. Schwarzenegger touted the agreement as a sign that California's economy was chugging along strong. The actor-cum-governor had previously vetoed two attempts by the legislature to raise the state minimum wage. He is up for re-election in November. California's largest union labor association voted to oppose a November ballot measure requiring teen girls to obtain parental notification before having an abortion. Leilani Albano has more from Los Angeles.
At a recent convention in Los Angeles, delegates of the California Federation of Labor reversed its no recommendation stance to a solid no vote on parental notification measure, Proposition 85.
I think it's a long overdue, very good step forward.
That was Wendy McPherson, member of the L.A.-based Radical Women, as well as the Librarians Union, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 2626.
It's a step towards what I hope will soon be a complete position in support of abortion rights. It's something that the labor movements needed to do for a long time.
United Farm Workers co-founder Dolores Huerta says that activists can do more to reach out to labor on the abortion issue.
I don't think we should take anything for granted. I think it's up to us in the women's movement to get out there and the progressive movement to get out there and talk to our local labor people and ask them to be sure to include this message, the non-85 message, and everything that they do.
Flight attendants for Northwest Airlines have customers on the mind as they prepare for possible random strike actions starting as early as Friday. Passengers concerned with their flights being delayed or canceled by the action, which could be as small as one plane or as big as the entire fleet, are being encouraged to sign up for a strike alert at nwaafa.org. The flight attendants are resisting attempts by the airline to impose a new contract. Here is today's economic report. This week marks the 10th anniversary of the last federal minimum wage hike. For 10 years, the federal minimum has remained stagnant at $5.15 per hour, a 51-year low when it comes to consumer buying power. In the meantime, states have taken it upon themselves to raise state minimums. Colorado is the most recent to come on board, with a proposal to be put before voters in November that would raise their minimum to $6.85 per hour. Also voting on a raise in November, Arizona, Nevada, Montana, Missouri, and Ohio.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Squalls out on the Gulf Stream. Big storms coming soon. Passed out in my hammock.
Welcome back.
Gotta slept away past noon.
5 minutes before the hour. I got a couple of minutes before we get a break for the top of the hour. And I just, you know, Larry Matheny thanked me for what I do for workers. And I got to tell you, I don't know if I can put into words what that says to me, because I'm entitled to no thanks. I'm entitled to no thanks whatsoever. Every day that I do anything in my life, it's working people that I owe thanks to. It's the UMWA that my grandfather belonged to, and my father, and my uncles, and Agnes's daddy, and Agnes's uncles. If it wasn't for that organization, I can assure you, I would not be sitting here. It's the aluminum workers that my father was a member of later on. It was organizations that allowed my family to rise up from something more than they were, who allowed them to have a voice, who allowed them to have dignity beyond the personal dignity that they carried. It was what organized labor allowed my family to do and to be, in terms of standing up and reaching for the equality that is the American dream. So with all due respect to our friend Larry Matheny, he owes me no thanks. And I owe all the thanks in the world, and Agnes owes all the thanks in the world, and my children owe all the thanks in the world to the men and women who are still carrying the flame that says working Americans are noble, working Americans are decent, working Americans are good, and working Americans are the America that is worth saving. That is where the thanks are due. So I was a little burdened with that, and I had to get it off my chest. Because I recognize, because I am a direct beneficiary of what good organized labor has been in these United States. I feel better now. So let's go to the top of the hour news and come back. And if you want to hear me babble on, feel free to do so. If you've got a bee under your bonnet, a burr under your saddle, then for God's sakes, do something about it, because bottling that stuff up is no good for you. The phone number is 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, Head On. This is the Head On Radio Network, and I'm Bob Kincaid.
American.
This is the Quality News Network. The U.S. Marine Corps is recalling thousands of Marines for active duty in Iraq and Afghanistan because not enough volunteers have enlisted. The call-ups will begin over the next few months, and there's no limit on the total number. It's the first time the Marines have resorted to a recall since the start of the Iraq War. In Iraq today, more than 100 known or suspected al-Qaeda terrorists and death squad leaders were arrested. 5 others were killed. Also, Iraqi officials announced they have begun their own investigation into the rape and slaying of a teenage girl in March. 6 U.S. soldiers have been arrested in connection with that case, which has increased calls for American troops to withdraw. 11 people who face terrorism-related charges appeared in a London court today. 8 were charged with conspiracy to commit murder and plotting to explode airliners over the Atlantic. The 3 others were charged with other terrorism-related offenses.
In Iran, officials say they're ready for serious negotiations about its nuclear program, but it's still not clear whether Tehran will suspend the program as demanded. U.S. Ambassador John Bolton says the U.S. is ready to move ahead with financial sanctions if Iran does not comply. In Rome, the Italian foreign minister said his country would contribute up to 3,000 troops to the international peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon, but only if Israel complies with the ceasefire. Italy is also expected to lead the 15,000-member force. European nations are expected to contribute up to 9,000 troops. In eastern Ukraine, all 170 people aboard a Russian passenger jet have been killed. The airline was on its way to St. Petersburg when it was reportedly struck by lightning. In Washington, an analysis of the Senate's immigration bill concludes that it would increase federal spending by $126 billion over the next 10 years. The Congressional Budget Office says that includes funding for law enforcement and building fencing and vehicle barriers. $50 billion would be spent on federal benefits for newly legalized immigrants. In Washington, the National Highway Traffic Administration says there were more traffic deaths in 2005 compared to 2004. In fact, there were more fatal accidents last year than in the last 15 years. And in California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger signed a law today that would lift the state's minimum wage to $8 an hour within the next 2 years. The state would then have the highest state minimum wage in the nation. You're listening to QNN.
Most people would rather have a root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to rightcarrightprice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to rightcarrightprice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
China has signed its first free trade agreement with the South American country, Chile, in order to get better access to its natural resources. In return, Chile will be able to access China's large market. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is expected to meet with Chinese President Hu Jintao this week. They're expected to strike a deal in which Beijing will buy more oil from Venezuela and Venezuela will buy oil tankers from Beijing. Sales at retail chain stores dropped 0.2% last week, and some analysts expect disappointing retail sales this month. Sprint Nextel's chief operating officer is leaving the country and being replaced by its chief executive. Sprint acquired Nextel last year in a $35 billion deal. Toll Brothers is giving up some building locations. That's after the luxury home builder's third quarter profits dropped 19%. 13 conservative groups are requesting an investigation into whether pornographic pay-per-view movies offered in hotel rooms violate federal and state obscenity laws. Their website, cleanhotels.com, lists lodging that does not offer porn. Ford is expected to unveil a new series of larger F-Series cleaner diesel engine trucks. The pickups will have more horsepower, better fuel economy, and a quieter engine compared to previous models. At the close of Wall Street today, the Dow was down 5 points, NASDAQ up 2, S&P 500 up 1. You can hear more at qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Kimberly White.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
I'm here. Let the bells ring out and the banners fly. It's too good to be true, but I'm here. I kid. You know, it's almost like a dentist office. I've got a copy of Time magazine from June 26th. It's a rule. You go to a doctor's or a dentist's office, all magazines are at least 2 months old. Fascinating article, Trying to Make a Decent Living. Here's the difference. This is the very palpable difference between having union representation and not having union representation. A lady named Robin Gray lives in Pittsburgh. Love Pittsburgh. Here's what Robin Gray does for a living. She cleans every night 48 kitchenettes. She dusts 90 conference rooms. She scrubs 40 glass doors at One Mellon Center, big old financial building in downtown Pittsburgh. She's 44 years old. She works from 9:30 p.m. to 6 a.m. She works 40 hours a week. She gets $12.52 an hour, and she has health insurance, 3 weeks paid vacation, and 3 personal days a year. Her annual salary is roughly $26,000, and she and her husband, they've got their own home. They send their 2 daughters to college. And just this past May, they got to take a vacation to Honolulu. There's one very, very simple answer why. Robin Gray lives in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is a city where the janitors have a union. And they've got a collective bargaining agreement. They have, in fact, a living wage. Now, you want the comparison? Here's your comparison. Craig Jones. Craig Jones lives in Cincinnati, Ohio. He dumps out 400 trash cans worth of garbage a night into the Cincinnati Textile Building's basement compactor. He's done it for 5 years. He's 27 years old. He gets $6.50 an hour. No benefits, no vacation time, no trip to Honolulu, no sick days. He works for a cleaning contractor called Professional Maintenance. And Professional Maintenance, because, you know, it's more important for the boss at Professional Maintenance to have a new car every year than it is for Craig Jones to have a living wage. They schedule him 4 hours a night, 5 days a week. 20 hours at $6.50. His biweekly paycheck is $260. Wait for it. Before taxes. His monthly rent is $215. He has a phone. He has a power bill, a water bill, a trash bill. He hasn't even bought a single new piece of clothing in time that he measures in years. He has no union. The union that Robin Gray belongs to in Pittsburgh took 20 years to bring to full fruition because the effort started in 1985. This is the America that we live in. This is the America that says no matter how hard you work, it doesn't matter. It used to be that there was an America that said hard work would be rewarded with a decent life. We're not talking about people trying to get out and be Don Blankenstein rich for doing nothing. We're talking about people who do something every day, who bust their asses, quite frankly. Hope you don't mind the language. This is the America that was given to us by the so-called Reagan Democrats. This is the America that was given to us by the Reagan conservatives. And the Bush Republicans, and the, this is going, Well, the right-wing religion industry. I'm darn sure not going to associate those freaks with the name of Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian carpenter. You see, this is their legacy. There's no shining city on a hill like Ronald Reagan said there was. The city on the hill gets cleaned by Craig Jones for $6.50 an hour. I got a picture of Mr. Jones here. Agnes, reckon Mr. Jones deserves a better life? And why? But wait! Before some right winger, well, you know, what makes you think they deserve it? I'll tell you what: the man works hard. This is a nation founded on the simple principle of the value of hard work. And what we have in the Republican Party, in Bill Frist, in George Bush, Dick Cheney, John Boehner, what we have in those goons is a commonly held belief that hard work means nothing or means less than nothing. Because you know what? George Bush and Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and Bill Frist and John Boehner and the rest of those thugs, I got news for you. They don't work hard. Bill Frist has never known a day's hard work in his entire life. He's a coupon clipper who led a life of privilege, and that life of privilege allowed him to go to Harvard, where he could then, while he was an intern or whatever at Mass General, he could go to the local animal shelters and adopt little kitty cats and take them home and cut them up. It's not hard work. Shall we go through the resume of George W. Bush again? Trust me, there's no hard work in it. The least person listening to this program, and frankly, it's really not fair to say this because every single human being listening to this program is probably a good 60 IQ points better than George Bush on their worst day, dead drunk downhill with a tailwind. The least person listening to this program could do a better job in the White House than George Bush. And would probably devote to the job the hard work that it deserves. The question for the future is whether or not we are going to take America back to a place that values hard work. That values human effort. You know, are we gonna be in America that actually, look, ladies, if you want to work, I want you to be able to go to work. If you have children, however, and you want to be able to stay home with those children, I want that to happen for you too. If you've got children and you want to work, I want there to be health care for you, and I want there to be health care for your kids, and I want there to be child care. So that you can at least have some confidence that while you're at work, your child is being attended to. And attended to competently. None of those things are ever, 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 ever going to happen under the rule of the Republican Party. Because under the Republican idea of government, it's every man for himself. And I do mean man, because ladies, you don't matter. I'm not trying to be hard, and I don't want anybody getting mad at me. But daggum, this is head on. That's how we deal with things. That is the way we approach things. We don't take our, we don't check our brains at the door. We do, with our heads firmly attached to our shoulders, we deal with the issues. And ladies, the Republican Party thinks less of you than they do of a draft mule.
Okay, Bob. I'm a girl, right?
Oh, man, what a girl you are.
Just wanted to make sure there. And you're right. They expect you to walk 10 steps behind your husband, don't look up, and don't say anything. They want you to be superwomen to do it all. The thing of it is I'm a mom. I know what it takes to take care of children. I know what it means to be worried that your children's going to be taken care of if you're away from them. I've done that. It's scary. If you don't have family to help you, if you're making minimum wage, you cannot pay someone. And I'm sorry, thank God for DHHR to help out, but they don't pay enough. So you're getting somebody that you don't know a whole lot about, that's been certified through them. How many stories have you read about children being severely injured, killed, because their caregivers weren't competent? And sometimes it doesn't hit home until it's your child.
And you see, dude, that's another point, because labor organizations that represent child care providers are actively engaged in teaching their membership how to be good and how to keep getting better at it. It's a safety issue.
It's not only that, though, but if funding keeps being cut, there's no one there, Bob. There's no one to take care of your children. You can't walk off and leave little ones in a house by themselves and expect to come home and everything to be okay. You can't do it.
Yeah. Well, Agnes, let's go to the phones. Our good friend Chris is calling from Alabama. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Well, Bob, I got to tell you, that suspect that was at the University of Virginia campus.
Mm-hmm.
It has been discovered that he was caught. He was asking Pastor Bynes if they knew the way to Don Blankenship's house. He was running low on cash. Okay, the FBI has a scenario set up. In case anything goes wrong with John Mark Carr, they've got a negotiator that can help. Clay Aiken.
Oh, man.
They're both asking the same thing.
Yeah. Well, no. In all seriousness, though, turns out the John Binet dude was a student at the University of North Alabama there in sunny Florence.
Yeah, he was a student teacher at Kilby Elementary, which is a part of University of North Alabama.
I think I think there's a weird little, like, universal portal karma hole or something. Dred Scott, of the Dred Scott decision?
Yeah.
He was a slave in Florence, Alabama, before he went to Missouri and got in all that trouble.
Oh, yeah. I wrote a letter to the editor recently that quite a few people were talking about, and I said, we have a blues festival here every year, the W.C. Handy Blues Festival. And I wrote that it was really charming to be in the crowd listening to the blues and hearing people making racial slurs about the African-American people that were playing the music.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
No. Please,
and
tell
in the
me
same way, to be sitting in a Mexican restaurant and someone order their food, and as soon as the waiter walks away, start talking about immigration and how we need to send these people back.
But not before they bring me my burrito.
Absolutely. I said, don't forget that black people, African Americans, used to work in houses around here not too long ago as servants. So
slaves.
Yeah. It wasn't in the order of history. It was yesterday.
Yeah. I know. And that's, well, one of the things that I love about the opportunities that this program presents for me is to share the voices of folks like Larry Matheny to be heard by Southern people.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a word Is there a word that Larry Matheny said that wouldn't, that doesn't absolutely resonate with any working person in the so-called red state South? What is it? What does a working person in red state South have to disagree with on the idea that a child who is born today deserves an opportunity to have a decent education, a decent life, a decent meal every day, decent clothing, a decent roof over his head? What is there to disagree with in any of that, Chris?
Do you really want to know?
Sure.
Well, as you well know, you grew up down here. What right does that child have? Now, this is the coldest, bloodest truth. This is what goes on down here. It all depends on who that child's parents are. It all depends on what part of the city or county, what neighborhood that child lives in.
Yeah, but there's only
depends on who his friends are, who his or her friends are.
Oh, I know all of that, Chris. But there's only one way to break that stranglehold, and that's organized labor.
Oh, absolutely.
Everything that saved the Deep South in the 20th century was brought about by organized labor.
Oh, absolutely.
Organized labor built the Tennessee Valley Authority.
And boy, they charged for it.
And in the long term, no, they didn't charge so much.
No, they charged. What I'm saying, they charged now. They have a monopoly on it. And if you don't like it, you can just go right ahead and do it.
Oh, well, I got to tell you the truth. I've seen a TVA power bill, Chris, and I can compare it with my own, and I'm telling you, you're getting a bargain.
Well, that may be, but.
But what I'm getting at, you know, that was, you know, union labor built all that.
Yeah.
Unions at Reynolds Aluminum and Ford and Diamond Shamrock and Union Carbide there on the banks of the Tennessee River, all of those things, those made life good for my generation there in the Tennessee Valley of Alabama.
I lived down the street from the man who negotiated Ford out of this area that put, what was it, 400 or 500 people out of work from really good paying jobs that went away and didn't come back. Until years later, and then they almost went away.
Well, Reynolds Aluminum is dead.
Yeah.
All but dead. And believe you me, it was killed. It wasn't a death by natural causes.
Oh, I know. It was
killed. And you know, it all corresponds and it all coincides, Chris, with the advent of, you know, I mean, we spend a lot of time hating George Bush. But you know what? I try to find a little bit of time every day to wish that I was somewhere near the grave of Ronald Reagan so I could work up a big old loogie and spit it all over his grave.
Well,
that's where so much of this begins.
I wrote something about Bush and Cindy Sheehan, but I'm not going to use it tonight. I'll save it for another time. The reason, one of the main reason I called, quite a while back, you made me an honorary West Virginian.
Yes.
And I have been lax in that, and I've been through a rough time here lately, so I'm now getting back to where I'm calling regular. Regular. That's the Southern expression.
Yeah, regular.
Should we just not wait until there's another accident in a mine, or should we be concerned about our miners now?
Oh God, the concern should never end.
Yeah.
Even under the circumstances where people are most paying attention to safety, and that is a situation in which mines are actively unionized, there will be accidents.
In terms of the nation, that was terrible. Those poor guys got killed. Okay, yeah. Let's go to the next story.
Look, it's
they're supposed to fix all this safety stuff, so we'll leave it alone because we're sure they're going to do it.
Yeah, well, see, that's the problem, though. It's the same attitude that prevailed with Katrina, frankly. And I'm not comparing Sago with Katrina. You can't do that. It would be evil to even make the attempt. But the same thing happened with both of them. The news cycle went around. Everybody went away, and the Sago widows cry in the night, and no one hears them now. And the poor, and the widows, and the orphans, and the widowers, and the dispossessed, and the homeless of Katrina cry in the night, and no one hears them. I mean, it's the media version of if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there, does it make a sound? And the apparent answer, Chris, is no, it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, God help us if the widows from those that passed in the Sago mine disaster, all the mine disasters, if they were to start lobbying, God knows what they'd get called.
Well, Well, you know what Ann Coulter'd call them.
Yeah, these women don't have Adam's apples out there that speak.
Well, not just that, but, you know, what did she call the 9/11 widows?
I won't even bring myself to that.
Right, I understand. Right. Well, do you think for an instant that she wouldn't call the Sago widows that if they dared?
Would.
But the fact of the matter is, Chris, here in West Virginia, on the national level, no sooner had principled people started to bring about some level of accountability, both within the government in the Mine Safety and Health Administration and outside the government in terms of regulations that would mandate safety. No sooner had that been put in place and started than a literal army of coal industry lobbyists began working on, and God knows they get help from the Bush administration, working on watering down those very same safety regs.
Mm-hmm.
More will die.
Oh, yeah.
And they will die, maybe the proximate cause will be a fire or an explosion or a roof cave in or a floor heaving up, but...
Yeah.
The ultimate prime cause of all of this will be the absolute disdain and lack of so much as a tinker's damn worth of care.
When all that I had read about the mining industry and listening to this show and calling in, I've got a real education, but, man, when I interviewed Judy Bonds and I asked those questions that I had been wanting an answer to, boy, did I get an education.
Oh, yeah, you will.
Oh, my goodness. That woman is amazing.
And it's my understanding that come Saturday at the rally, West Virginians United, the rally in Charleston, it's my understanding that Judy and several other members of Coal River Mountain Watch will be there standing side by side with working people. I mean, and this is, I'm so in favor of what's going to go down there because it speaks so much to a theory that I have put forward, and I think we're figuring it out, and it gives me heart, Chris, because working people's issues are environmental issues, are women's issues, are children's issues, are human rights issues, it's all one thing. It all means something. It's all tied together.
It most certainly is. It is all one. Absolutely. They're life issues.
That's, yeah, and what's going on Saturday in Charleston is a manifestation of that very thing.
Boy, I tell you, if I lived up there, I would be there with them. I admire her so much. I've read people that said, she's just wanting fame for herself. No.
The people, the trolls that come out and are mean are extremely mean.
Yeah.
But you got to understand that meanness comes with an agenda. That's because they're afraid. That's because they know that the fight is finally being taken to them.
Show up and be counted.
Yeah.
This is a woman who was threatened in the capital of West Virginia, and the police just wandered away.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, let's not get involved in this.
No. We're just the police. We don't want to get involved.
Yeah. But every time you use your electricity, every time you turn on a light or whatever, you've got to think about these poor miners.
Yeah, that wall switch means something, Chris. Thank you for saying that. You are absolutely correct. That wall switch means something.
It breaks my heart to know that these guys are going through this. I write as much as I can. I do as much as I can. I wish I could afford to do more. But I don't even live in West Virginia.
I've never
been to West Virginia. I hope to someday.
But you get it, Chris. And like I said, talking to Loretta Nall earlier this evening, there's coal in Alabama too, and there's tragedy that goes with it. The Jim Walter explosion in 2001 was a stark and heart-rending reminder that by God, there's coal in Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Not long after, Stego happened. They talked to a gentleman here in Alabama, and he was just like, things aren't always bad as they seem. And I'm like, oh, yeah. You've been working topside for a while now, haven't you, Hoss?
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. And he looked rather scrubbed and clean in a white shirt and that brand-new off-the-counter white hard hat.
Yeah.
You know the kind.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
But,
well, Chris, don't sell yourself short because because you're not here. Because that's the beauty of the Internet. That is the beauty of global broadcasting via the Internet. Your actions there can make a difference here. Frankly, they can make more of a difference there than they can make here. If you can teach people in Alabama, because, you know, if you go over across the bridge and you go out a little ways out 72 westbound toward Mississippi, you will see the great big old stacks of the Colbert steam plant.
Oh, I need to say one more thing.
Yeah.
My wife and one of our best friends, we went to Iuka over to Mississippi, which is about an hour away.
Oh, yeah, I know it well.
And we proctored some exams for some crane operators. It's been about 2 weeks ago, one Saturday. And we participated in that and helped them get certified and up their certification for these very hardworking, very friendly union men.
Hot damn.
And one woman. We had the best time, and I was so proud to do it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, this stuff matters, Chris. It matters. It's reaching out. It's talking to people. This is the grassroots, Chris.
A bunch of the guys were, we appreciate y'all doing this. You know, not everybody that does this is kind or whatever. We told them, point blank, look, we know you guys get screwed often enough. I don't see that you have to get screwed today. Why on earth? You get the rough side all the time. We don't think you ought to have to today. We'll do everything we can for you. And I know that they did better on their test than they would have because we actually show concern. A lot of those guys, a father and his son, took the test. They got through about 4 o'clock. They got in their truck. They were driving all the way from Iuka, Mississippi to Lake Charles, Louisiana to start work the next morning on a new job.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to be there at 6. So those guys have worked their butts off. They're working down there in that mess down there right now. So why couldn't we why couldn't anybody try and make their day a little better? I was very proud to help them out.
This is the stuff that matters, Chris.
Absolutely.
And then, and it didn't.
Great work.
Well, thanks, Chris. I appreciate it. And it's.
And if you weren't, I wouldn't call you.
I know you wouldn't. And if I think if I was boring, you wouldn't listen. So you know.
Well, actually, that might be kind of interesting. You know, I've listened to some pretty. Oh man.
Not for me, I hope.
No. The local religious university here is having Sean Hannity.
No.
A couple of weeks for a fundraiser.
Ick. The religious university?
Oh, yeah.
The one out at Industrial Park?
IBC, which is now a Heritage.
Yeah, out at Industrial Park.
Sean Hannity come.
Well, I tell you what, that sure is a religious topic. And I bet you won't be able to get near the place either.
Maybe they'll just have a church kid beauty show after that, and Sean can be the judge. I don't know.
With that, we will quit, Chris.
All righty.
Take care, brother.
Take care. You too.
You keep the faith. Bye now. Chris just said something. No, he did. He said it's very important. It's awareness. It's comprehension. It's knowing what happens when you flip the switch. But that's one aspect. It's the stuff we don't think about that works to our detriment. Everything you touch, everything that happens in your life has happened because someone, and I don't give a rat's ass about a CEO. Yeah, somebody's got to be the boss, I understand that. But it's not the CEO who makes it go. It's the guy who drives the forklift. It's the people on the production line. Gee, money. I heard stories from a representative of the Smithfield campaign while I was up in D.C. And I think I've said before, I'm not a vegetarian, but these guys are trying real hard to make me one. And I don't mean the organizer. I mean the people who treat the people who work in. There's over 5,000 people that work at the Smithfield packing or processing plant in Tar Heel, North Carolina. You smell Tar Heel, North Carolina before you see Tar Heel, North Carolina. And when you get to Tar Heel, North Carolina, there ain't a hell of a lot to see. Because what they have there is a pork concentration camp. They kill 32,000 hogs a day. And it's industrialized, and it's an assembly line. And the injuries are horrid there. And, you know, I got to tell you, I can't, I mean, no. I go through the grocery store, I see Smithfield now, and I think about the Smithfield Justice Campaign's slogan, packaged with abuse. And that abuse is of the workers, let alone what's happening to the animals. It's the workers. It's women who are 8 months pregnant wielding steel knives side by side with other people wielding steel knives razor sharp that is afraid to take time off until her water breaks because she's afraid she won't have a job to come back to. My God, just Google up Smithfield Justice. It'll take you to, you'll learn. And if you can bring yourself in a grocery store to buy anything with Smithfield on it ever again, I'll be amazed. 32,000 animals a day. Run the math out. That's two lines going, two shifts, 16 hours. That's 1,000 animals. Yeah, 1,000 animals. No, 2,000. Do the math. I'm not the math guy. Everything you touch, everything that you come in contact with, everything that happens for you in your daily life, some worker has taken some portion of his or her life to make happen for you. You know, I'm the weird guy that calls the consumer comment line to tell people I like what they do, and to thank people, or who asks for a supervisor when I'm dealing with somebody in customer service. Listen, let me talk to your supervisor because you've done a good job for me, and they need to know you're doing a good job. And I don't hesitate when that happens. I get the supervisor on the line and I say, listen, I was just talking with so-and-so, and that person needs a raise. And you know what? It costs me nothing to do that. And I'm not this is not Bob Kincaid wonderful guy moment, okay? That's not what this is about. It's consciousness. It's awareness. It's remembering that that the people who make things happen for you are as human as you are. It's what will make you feel good about having been on planet Earth when you get to the end of your trip here. What's that old bumper sticker thing? We are spiritual beings having a human experience. That. You know? So, listen, I'm a little dry-throated. I'm going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll roll on downhill to the end of the program. There's a little bit of time if you want to get your thoughts in. 877, the number 4, head on. 877-443-2366. This, of course, is the Head On Radio Network, and I, of course, am Bob Kincaid.
You made it in a There's a place on the web you can go where everything is so topical you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. Clyde, Wally, and Dookie are there working hard for you every day. It's a place where you can go to raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com. DUBYAD40.com. So stop on by. The 101st Fighting Keyboardists of Kansas are ready to hear your opinion. There are topics of news, current events, and great humor. So let Clyde, Wally, and Dookie know that you're a working person too. WD40.com. Stop on by.
This is Bruce Birch, and I'd like to invite you to join me for a brand new show here on the Horn, the Bruce Birch Radio Program. Tune in Monday through Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
James Means, straight talk, and great guests like author and reporter Greg Palast.
Do we have Greg on the phone?
Yes, we do.
All right, very good, Greg.
Greg talked about his new book, Armed Madhouse.
You'll see in the second chapter of the book about Big Oil that I was able to get the inside documents from inside the State Department for the plans for the oil fields of Iraq, which is, you know, what it, you know, it's about the oil. And you actually, you know, if you thought they had a secret plan, I go and get it.
Greg Palast, thank you so much.
Don't miss Guy James weekday afternoons, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Seventeen minutes before the hour, I'm Bob. It's been a very, very pleasant evening. A lot of stuff that all somehow or another seems to connect. Sort of like mental Lego, if you know what I mean. Let's go to the phones. Jim is joining us from an undisclosed location somewhere in the wilds of West Virginia. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Doing good, you?
Pretty good.
Good.
I know this might not relate to some of the stuff you've been talking about, but I just finished two books by Barbara Tuchman. One is called The Proud Tower, and the other is called The Guns of August. I think that's me with that one.
I have not read The Proud Tower.
Proud Tower, 1966. And it describes European civilization in modern Europe from 1870 to 1914.
Okay, because I think I read the predecessor to that one, and I can't remember the title now, that had to do with medieval Europe.
But anyway, in the Proud Tower, there's a section devoted to labor movement, syndicalism, and things of that nature. And the excesses that were wrought upon the working classes by the upper classes in certain countries, and honestly, ironically enough, the country that had the most humane policy toward the working man was the Kaiser's Germany.
Well, yeah.
And he had instituted all types, or had been the Reichstag, or well, the Hohenzollerns had actually instituted all types of insurance programs for working men, including unemployment insurance, hospitalization, things of that nature, to combat the forces of, you know, socialism and communism because they knew that they were rampant, whereas in England, all they had was the workhouse. And when Churchill visited Germany, he realized how behind Britain was. And, of course, in Austria-Hungary and in Russia, I don't think they had a great deal to take care of people.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you mention Churchill. I've made Churchill a bit of a study over the last several years. I've read a number of biographies, and the place where I started college housed the Winston Churchill Memorial in the United States. So I got doused in Churchillabilia from an early age educationally. Mm-hmm. In what you mentioned, it reminds me of something. I wonder if a Churchill could survive in the filthy political climate that we have now, Jim. Because in one particular instance, Winston Churchill, during his Tory days, was a vociferous opponent of workers' compensation. And this was back at the time when it was first being contemplated.
But
you know, he was against it before he was for it. I mean, can you imagine Winston Churchill, the standing for election in his area being followed around like John Kerry was by a guy in a dolphin suit screaming flip flop flip flop?
Well, I'm not sure, but I know that Churchill had some very unpopular policies. As a matter of fact, even though he was able to leave them out of World War II, he was defeated before he could even get back to Potsdam.
Oh, he was he was thrown out of government more times than some drunks are thrown out of bars.
Well, he was a pretty cantankerous fellow at times. I mean, he had his own
one
view
one,
of the world.
Yeah, but, one and, word. And Gallipoli.
Well, that was a very serious mistake, and it cost him a great deal, and it cost a lot of other men more than just a great deal. It cost them their lives because it was a ridiculous thing to have set those men up against those machine gun emplacements that held by the Turkish army. And that's about the only movie that Mel Gibson's done that I really think anything of, because I think it really describes what happened there. But Churchill, yeah, he could survive today. If he could survive that, if he could come back and be as resilient as he was and lead his country through the Blitz and through the dark days of the Second World War, he could survive today. I'm sure he could. And also, there is an excellent series out on DVD. It's called The Fall of Eagles, and it's a dramatization put out by the BBC in 1974. And it deals with the period from the accession of Archduke Francis Ferdinand to the assassination of the Romanovs, and it deals with those three dynasties, the Romanovs, the Hohenzollerns, and the Habsburgs. And I don't know who did the sets or the scenery for this thing and wrote the dialogue for it, but it's absolutely superb. You can get it as I found it in a little thing that has advertised his books in DVDs and things like that. Four DVDs for $36. You can't beat that.
Oh, no. The Fall of Eagles, you say? The
Fall of Eagles.
Okay. I'll jot that down.
I mean, it has a series of stories on each DVD. For example, one deals with the marriage of Francis Ferdinand to Elizabeth, the last Empress of Austria. And then another one deals with the suicide of their only son, Rudolf, at Meierling with his mistress. And then the other one deals with the Kaiser and how he was brought up in Bismarck and the influence he had upon the Kaiser's father and the Kaiser until the Kaiser kicked him out. And then it goes into the Russian, it goes into the British, and then it deals a great deal of one section with the labor movement and the accession of Lenin as the leader of the Bolshevik Party and how he broke away from the Mensheviks and things of that nature. I mean, for someone who enjoys history, as I think you do, and other people who may be listening, I would suggest those two books, The Proud Tower, 1966, Barbara Tuchman, The Guns of August, 1960, Barbara Tuchman, and The Fall of Eagles.
Well, the gun, I've got, you know, I need to get my head... You cannot buy a bad book with Barbara Tuchman's name on it.
No, you can't.
And I need to. I had that, and it's probably in a box somewhere. I need to dig it out and reread it.
Well, I think you will find in that book the most definitive thing that deals with how nations were led into a conflict. Now, she wrote several things: the Bible and the Sword, the Zimmerman Telegram, and Notes from China and A Distant Mirror.
That's the one. A Distant Mirror.
Mm-hmm. That came out in 74, 76 or 74, 70, excuse me, 78, I think.
Yeah.
And for people who might think that history is dry and unreadable, this is the most readable and...
You can't put them down.
...digestible account of things as they happened then, and it certainly helps the reader, in my opinion, to relate to things as they're happening today.
Well, and that's the and that's the whole point of history, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Because
the DVD series is the most incredible thing that I have seen in a long, long time. And I'm a real believer in visual literacy because I love to watch dramatizations of things.
Well, and speaking, you mentioned it was a BBC production. I was thinking only earlier today of the BBC production of I, Claudius.
What's that now?
I, Claudius, Robert Graves' retelling of the Suetonius accounts of the Caesars.
Yeah, gospel and, thing, wasn't he?
Oh, a little bit.
Well, they were a strange crowd, those Julio-Claudians, and plus some of the others, and some of the bad ones that came in there. But I guess we all have our share of those, as we well know, looking at today's circumstances, but... Let's hope that George doesn't go home and stomp Laura to death or something, okay?
Jury might be... No, I'm being cruel.
Let's go.
Let's go. Jim, thanks so much. Have a great night, all right?
Okay, you too.
Bye
now. Here now.
And moving to our good friend Andy calling from the UK. Hey, Andy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how's it going?
Going well, you?
Yeah, not too bad. I was trying to hold off and ring in on Friday and just have missed a week, but... The Gallipoli thing, I had to ring in. It wasn't Churchill's fault. His plan was absolutely excellent, and the reason it's excellent is it was proved on Normandy, okay? Now, his plan was land a whole bunch of dudes, get them up the cliffs sharpish because there's no Turks up there, and then drive hell for leather for Byzantium or Constantinople, whatever you want to call it. Unfortunately, the dudes that actually carried it out, because they were under the influence of a guy that didn't like Churchill very much, just left the men on the beaches. When Churchill turned up, he saw men playing in the water and playing football and cricket on the
beach. Well, there was a failure of His Majesty's Navy as well, wasn't there?
Well, that was it. It was the admirals that didn't like the plan, and they didn't like the fact that Churchill had got his plan approved when their plan had been sort of denied.
But wasn't this when Churchill was actually First Lord of the Admiralty?
No, he wasn't the First Lord at that point. I think he became the First Lord later on. If he was, then it was somebody below him, but I was under the impression it was somebody above him that kind of pulled some strings and some other people.
Because there was supposed to be, and you know, oddly enough, there was supposed to be on D-Day in Normandy as well, and it wasn't carried out quite as much as they might have hoped for, massive naval bombardment of the Turkish positions.
Well, yeah, the Navy didn't do their job, and the Army didn't do its job properly, and Churchill was the guy that...
And the dudes on the beach got hung out to dry.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was his plan, and he wasn't allowed to carry the plan out. He wasn't given overall command of it, so whoever was actually commanding it should take the rap.
Because the way that he had it laid out, it was going to end the war, period.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, they would have taken control of Constantinople, and that would have been it, because they would have been able to just crush the opposition in Europe from the south.
Because they would have been in their rear and they would have been on their flank, and yeah.
Yeah. But you know, I had to.
Well, I know that's, you know, we get into these little historical set twos, and
yeah. Well,
it's part of what makes all this so much fun.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, Churchill wasn't exactly a nice guy. I mean, he was a pretty evil and nasty old drunk, you know. But he did best for people in the end. You know what I mean? He wasn't exactly particularly nice earlier on in his life.
But you don't necessarily need nice. You need the guy who can do. You need the leader. You know,
yeah.
This country, and frankly, I would submit that the United Kingdom is dying for a leader right now.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I'd like to point out to everybody that says that drugs are bad that Churchill got through the war on a combination of cocaine sweets and alcohol. Oh, and nicotine.
Yeah, don't forget the cigars. You know, I mean, you know, you get, I mean, and I mean, like I said, I've read William Manchester's biography and a couple of others. And the guy starts out his day propped up on pillows in a big comfy bed with a honk and snort of, I think it was scotch, wasn't it? A lot of people said it was brandy, but it was actually, there was either scotch or bourbon. Big snort of scotch and a cigar and, you know, enough cholesterol to kill a 21st century human.
Mm-hmm.
And all he managed to do was effectively save the erstwhile free world.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Hitler was a vegetarian.
Yeah, well, don't get the cocaine lozenges for Churchill.
Well, they will perk you up a little, won't they?
Well, he survived on like 2.5 hours sleep a night for, what, 6 years, and he was a fairly old man when it started.
93, if I recall correctly. Maybe 95.
Hmm.
So, you know, I don't... if you've got adequate health care and you've got the right personal constitution... maybe we're getting some of this wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe there's room for excess as long as it's done what, judiciously.
Well, I've always felt that a judicious bit of indulgence can be good for you.
Yeah, it's the 8 day drunks that'll put a few saddle sores on you. Andy, good to hear from you. Sorry I wasn't around Friday night, but I hope we'll hear from you this Friday.
Well, yeah, I'll be ringing in.
All right, you take care now.
Will do. Thank you.
Have a great Wednesday.
I'll think about that.
Bye now.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, everybody. Thanks. That's it. The program tonight was, of course, produced by my darling, lovely, talented wife, Agnes. Announced by Brian Reznor. The chief engineer of the Head On Radio Network is John Fox in Sydney, Australia. Our IT professional is Peter Godbold of Godbold Computer Services in Tallahassee, Florida. All the streaming, all the archiving, the podcasting is all maintained and actuated and made happen by Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. Ben is, in fact, the hardest working man in liberal talk because he not only does all that for the horn, but he maintains the archives for a number of fine liberal and progressive talk programs, not the least of which is our good friend Mike Malloy, who's coming up in about, 8 minutes on that other liberal network. Ben has a fundraiser still going on. He needs to get to his goal. If you haven't contributed yet and you have the ability to do so, please do so. Now, all of these things happen. The entire Head On Radio Network happens because of the several thousand members of the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Every day they get up and they go out and